Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you today, and we pick up now on our conversation about the life and influence of Nancy Reagan on a subject that's probably the one the public remembers her best for.
Say yes to your life, and when it comes to drugs and alcohol, just say no.
I think you can see why Nancy has been such a positive influence on all that we're trying to do.
That's Nancy Reagan and, of course, President Ronald Reagan in a joint address on September 14th, 1986. The Just Say No campaign permeated popular culture at the time. How did the White House think it would reach young people then? Nancy Reagan breezed in for a turn with Gary Coleman on the three-camera sitcom Different Strokes. Listen.
I'm really here to see Arnold.
Who talking about Mrs. Reagan?
Well, you know, I'm very concerned about drug abuse, especially among the young. And I was very impressed at the way that you spoke out.
Oh, it's nothing any other fearless journalist dedicated to the truth wouldn't do.
All right, so you got the laugh track there. That appearance stands up today as a famous bit of 1980s TV kitsch, but it's also a testament to what is now seen by many in hindsight as maybe the simplistic and naive message of the war on drugs, Just Say No. And we want to find out if the message worked at all, and if not, why not? What's the legacy of Nancy Reagan's key part in the war on drugs? Carl Hart is professor at Columbia University, author of High Price, A Neuroscientist's Journey of Self-Discovery That Challenges Everything You Know About Drugs and Society, and he joins me. Carl Hart, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Todd.
As I said, Just Say No was often criticized for being simplistic and naive and ignoring real-world situations around drugs, especially with young people. Your thoughts?
Well, it was more than just being simplistic, because oftentimes people talk about the war on drugs and the Just Say No sort of mantra as being a failure, and when in fact it was actually kind of successful for a number of people. It failed the majority of the American taxpayers, but for a number of people, it's been successful. That's why it continues. And when I say it's been successful in helping to create this environment in which any drug use is seen as being pathological. And so that overly simplistic message, yeah, it certainly didn't do much for drug education, but it did a hell of a lot for people who are currently making a lot of money off of the war on drugs.
Another thing that it did, maybe that was positive, was it did identify drug initiation among the young as a critical issue. Even if the message itself didn't work, it got America focused on the importance of not starting in the first place, perhaps.
No, that's wrong.
Okay.
Drug initiation has always been a concern in the United States. I mean, long before Nancy Reagan, you go back to the early 1900s, people were concerned about that. And so I don't think so. I think that it did unequivocally for most Americans a horrible thing, because when we think about don't start in the first place, there will be people who start. The concern is how do we prevent abuse, and how do we educate people to not get in trouble with these sorts of things? The notion that people won't start, that's naive, and that is dangerous, actually.
So is the main problem here then that Just Say No crowded out other important forms of education that young people should have been getting at the time with that simplicity?
That's one of the main problems. But it also, I think in that speech that you played, you didn't play it all the way through. It was 1986 September when the president and Ms. Reagan faced the nation or talked to the nation about drugs. She was talking about us as a nation being intolerant of people who use drugs. And that is just simply inappropriate. And that's not what we want people to do. We don't want people to be intolerant of a number of things, and certainly not drug use. Not that we want people to engage in drug use, but we have to understand that people will engage in drug use. And the question becomes, how do we keep people safe when they do engage?
So what do you see then when you – or hear, I should say, when you listen to Nancy Reagan as a communicator? That message was simplistic, but it did permeate. So evaluate her as a communicator, even if you think the message – failed.
I think she was an outstanding communicator. I think her husband was an outstanding communicator. I think that many of the politicians today can take some lessons from Nancy and Ronald in terms of their communication skills. That's clear. I mean, as we think about that 1986, September 1986 speech that they gave to the nation, those two on the couch looking like the national parents and also sounding like the national parents in terms of their persuasiveness and it being compelling. They were excellent. I don't think that's a question.
So the drug problem is still with us, of course. We all know that some attitudes have changed drastically, especially as it relates to marijuana. Redesign for a second an effective drug message. Let's imagine the president and Michelle Obama on, I don't know, Big Bang Theory, maybe a popular show today, going on to talk to the nation about drugs. What should it sound like?
Well, first of all, I don't accept the notion that the drug problem is still with us today. That's one of the problems is people think of the drug problem as being about drugs. And I think it's a misunderstanding and it's a misplacement of where our focus should be. Too often the focus is on the drugs themselves. When you think about the facts are this. The vast majority of people who use any of these drugs that we're talking about don't have a problem. That tells you that the problem is not the drugs. The problem lies elsewhere. So when you think about what Mr. Obama and what Ms. Obama should say to the nation, they should think about those other factors like are people employed? Are we taking care of other co-occurring psychiatric illnesses that may be playing a role in people's abuse of drugs? Do people have opportunities? Do people have the skills to temper their behavior in any domain, not only with drugs, but any other domain? So there are a variety of things I like the current president to say and do, but the focus will not be on drugs.
Final thoughts before we let you go, Carl. You know, should Nancy Reagan or the White House of the 1980s, should they have seen this, or was it a necessary episode to go through to maybe reach a different understanding, hopefully, that we're reaching today?
This is really clear. When we think about the negative consequence that occurred as a result of this simplistic message, it has primarily decimated communities of color. And so if those same sorts of negative effects were happening in communities in which in white communities in this country, I assure you, this thing would not be so prevalent today. This message, this outdated message, this misinformed message, this message that has done so much harm. I assure you. So when you say, should they have known, they would have known if the consequences were with the constituents that that they cared about.
A look back at the legacy of Nancy Reagan as communicator in the War on Drugs, the Just Say No campaign, perhaps big opportunities missed and problems ignored. Carl Hart, professor at Columbia University. He's author of High Price, A Neuroscientist's Journey of Self-Discovery that challenges everything you know about drugs and society. Professor, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Tupac, keep your head up, when did you stop? Love and die, color your skin, color your eyes. That's the real blues, baby, like you met Jay's, baby. You blew me away, you think more beauty in blue, green, and gray. On my Solomon up north, 12 years a slave, 12 years of age, thinking my shade too dark.
I love myself, I no longer need Q-Puck. Enforcing my dark side like a young George Lucas. Light don't mean you smart, being dark don't make you stupid. A frame of mind for them busters, ain't talking woo-ha. Need a paradox for the paradox, they tutored. Like two tides, LL, you lose two times. If you don't see your beautiful in your complexion, it ain't complex to put it in context. Find the air beneath the kite, that's the context. Yeah, baby, I'm conscious, ain't no contest. If you like it, I love it, all your earth tones been blessed. Ain't no stress, jigaboos wanna be. I ain't talking J, mm-mm, I ain't talking B. I'm talking days we got school watching movie screens. That spike your self-esteem, the new James Bond gonna be black as me. Black as brown hazelnut, cinnamon, black tea. And it's all beautiful to me. Call your brothers magnificent, call all the sisters queens. We all on the same team, blues and pyrus, no colors ain't a thing.
Growing up in New Orleans, Yaba Blaye's life was in many ways influenced by the color of her skin. She was a first-generation Ghanaian-American, and she was proud of her dark skin. But she started to notice that this set her apart from the area's light-skinned Creole community. As a child, Yaba remembers not being invited to her best friend's birthday party because she was too dark. Later in life, her skin tone kept her from being invited to a colleague's wedding. Experiences like these led Yaba Blaye to study colorism in the African diaspora. In 2013, she published One Drop, Shifting the Lens on Race. Through dozens of perspectives, the book grapples with questions like what exactly is blackness and what does it mean to be black? These questions now guide Yaba Blaye in her work at North Carolina Central University in Durham. She is the Dan Blue Endowed Chair in Political Science at Central and my guest on The State of Things. Yaba Blaye, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
When did you start noticing those nuances and those differences?
I mean, as a child, you know, I tell people that, you know, my skin color is reflective of my Ghanaian ancestry, and so in my family. And in Ghana, there's nothing unique about my skin tone, you know, so that was normative at home. But again, stepping outside and being told from the time I was very young, you know, you're so black or, you know, you're dark, like it was constant commentary. And it was something that continued to come up. And so I knew very early on that there was something different about me.
Was this something you took home? Did you talk? Both of your parents are from Ghana.
Yes.
So did you talk about it at home?
You know, I honestly don't remember talking about it at home. My parents, they were strict and they were on a mission. And so I knew that they sent me to school to learn. And so coming home to talk was to talk about what I had learned. I don't remember actually talking about those kinds of personal concerns with my parents.
What about your father's sense of being here? Did he detect any of that, or was that any part of his experience as a professional, as an academic who had studied in the United States?
You know, what's interesting is that when I got to grad school and started mapping out my research and talking to my father about my work and what I wanted to do is when he started telling me his own kind of stories about his experience in New Orleans. And my father is much darker than I am. And so he talked about literally getting to New Orleans in the early 70s and having colleagues on campus not wanting to sit next to him because of his skin color, not wanting to, you know, associate with him, and maybe not just because of his skin color, but then he's also African, you know, coming from another country. So, yeah, he had his own experiences with colorism as well.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Glad you could be here with us. Not sure if you've noticed, but today is International Women's Day. And in this half hour, we'll be hearing stories about how women around the globe are fighting for their rights. In a few, one woman's battle in Brazil to save her home from demolition ahead of the Rio Olympics. Let's turn first, though, to an issue that many women around the world are fighting, the obsession with lighter skin. In Nigeria, for example, one of the most popular cosmetic products for women is a skin lightening cream. And in India and cultures across Asia, women grow up believing that fairer skin is better than darker skin. So what is behind this obsession with lighter skin? Naini Tyagaraja, a Sri Lankan-Canadian filmmaker, has made a documentary called Shadism. Naini, what do you think is going on with this obsession with fair skin?
Well, shadism is an issue that's existed globally for centuries. I would connect it directly to histories of colonialism across the world. That's why you see it everywhere. And this idea that power and beauty is associated with whiteness. I can give one personal example. Coming from Sri Lanka, which experienced successive colonization, first by the Dutch, then the Portuguese, and then the British, power and beauty was associated with white people and whiteness.
At a personal level, Nini, do you consider your own skin dark or fair? And when did this whole thing become a thing in your life?
I was considered fair by my family, and a lot of the commentary that I experienced wasn't necessarily for being darker skinned, but more so for preserving or maintaining or not losing my lighter skin. And so a lot of the commentary was to stay out of the sun so that I wouldn't, so to say, lose my color, which is an interesting way to phrase it. Mm. I always laugh because we've traveled a lot for the film, and so even my mother has said, you've lost your skin color forever because of all the travel. And it's interesting to hear that commentary even now after working on the film.
Were you put on a pedestal because you had light skin?
Yeah, and I don't think I noticed it as much when I was younger. Looking back, I can see that I grew up with a lot of privilege. For me, weight was always my issue. So now looking back at a lot of my experiences, yes, there was definitely a difference.
So you've made this documentary, Shadeism, and I'm just curious to know, what was it like making this and meeting women who have very different values placed on the shade of their skin?
Yeah, I think that's one of the biggest challenges that I faced, and rightfully so. I think it was an important critique from other women of color who questioned, what does it mean for me as a South Asian woman who, for the larger part of my life, has been lighter skinned, to tell these stories ethically and responsibly when that's not my experience. But it was an important critique because if I didn't receive that earlier on, I don't think I would have been cognizant to tell the stories in an honest way.
So there's the cultural aspect. There's also the health aspect to skin lightening that's really negative. How many women did you meet while you were making this doc who used bad skin lightening products and permanently damaged their skin in the name of beauty?
We traveled to Somalia, and when we spoke to women there, they all talked about how it's normalized to use skin lightening creams, and that if you don't do it, people think that you don't have money or that you can't afford it. And even lighter skin women express the fact that using skin lightening creams is important because you feel like the darker skin women are catching up to your skin tone. And so that was kind of an interesting sentiment I heard there. The only other person in the film who openly admitted to using skin lightening cream was my mother. She'd never gone for bleaching at a beauty salon, but she had used the creams. Maybe I think she stopped using them 2 years ago, but she had been using them.
So what is the argument you would present for why women should not use these skin lightening creams? Is it about self-acceptance, and how well does that work in parts of the world where women are not empowered?
What I've seen in terms of shadeism and actual movements, there is a movement in India, the Dark and Lovely campaign, which really pushes for, you know, acceptance and respect and love for women with darker skin. But I think that it really starts with conversations in our communities and with others about how it makes us feel. I think that's where the change really starts to happen, and we don't have to look outside for it.
Filmmaker Nini Tyagaraja will be screening her documentary, Shadeism, about the trend of skin lightening products, tonight in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Nini, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
The colors are lovely, of course. But nothing says perfection like white.
Pew white.
Since you did research, or you looked into skin bleaching, which was an important topic. I mean, people would do this not because inherently perhaps they think it's, but because generally it turns out to be more acceptable. There are privileges that come.
Right. And so with me getting into the work on skin bleaching, I think one of the motivating factors was having looked at the literature, a lot of which was journalistic, and having male reporters talk about women, African women who bleach their skin, and talk about them in such a way like, well, these are just foolish African women who want to be white. These are just women who are suffering from a colonial mentality. And I know very early on I was driven and moved to, for lack of a better word, defend them. If nothing else, to show their humanity, right? Because you're not just talking about women who exist in a vacuum. So if we want to be real and we want to talk about a colonial mentality, so women and men bleach their skin, yes, but our judges and people in parliament in Ghana, for example, still wear powdered wigs. We still name our children by Christian Western names. We don't teach languages, our own native tongues. We don't teach that in the school because we think that students need to learn English in order to be acceptable and successful. And so what I'm saying is that there are so many different manifestations of this so-called colonial mentality. It's just too easy to pick on African women.
I see. But then but what about any of these sort of adaptations to an imposition? I mean, do you see some of these values as superimposed by colonialism or any other kind of
Absolutely. Yeah. So I think historical context, political context is always important. So if we're talking about skin bleaching, see, my thing is we can't pathologize people. You pathologize people when you don't provide a context within which to understand why they are behaving, why they have the needs that they do, or the wants or the desires that they do. Like, we're not existing in a vacuum. So when I look at skin bleaching, we got to look at that in the context of white supremacy. We have to look at that in the context of the history of colonization in that space. And so even though the British may have left Ghanaian soul, they left their values behind, you know? And so if you have hundreds of years of a dominant force basically telling you that, you know, literally because of the color of my skin, literally because of where I come from, it's almost like I'm ordained to be in power. Not just I've earned this, but this is my rightful place in power, and it's very much linked to how I look and where I come from. And so African people also wanting some access to that power. How do I get access to it, right? We got to throw in commodity racism in there, right? So you make products for people to bleach their skin, and then you denigrate them for using it. It can't work both ways.
The people who are constantly forced to move from one place to another, either the water is rising and they have to move, or in some cases the water is not rising but the prices are rising in the area where they are, and they can no longer stay there because they can't afford to be where they are, so they raise the prices on everything. They foreclose on the house that a person is in. That person has got to move. Because they have found that when people are constantly moving, they are dislocated. And they are angry and they are frustrated and they can't get their bearings. They can be almost driven insane by having to do that. And then they become completely dysfunctional.
Well,
and then they are totally vulnerable. So that's one of the major strategists for misusing people. Keep them on the move. Dislocation. Racial dislocation.
Apparently, the skin lightening trend has even captured the market in Brazil now, a country that seemingly has room for many, many different skin tones. But this next story is about a woman in a Rio slum who's been waging a different fight to keep her home from being demolished ahead of the Olympics. Maria da Penha is her name. She's a resident and activist in the Vila Autodromo favela in Rio de Janeiro. The favela, or what's left of it, sits in the shadows of the new Olympic Park. Over the last few months, the government has been demolishing homes there to make way for new construction, and this morning they tore down Maria da Penha's house, one of the last ones still standing there. Will Carlos with our Global Post team is based in Rio, but is with us in Boston this week. Last week, Will, you interviewed Maria da Penha outside her home. Take us to this favela. Where is it in Rio? And give us the before and after shots. What did it look like before Olympic construction started? And what does it look like now?
So I wasn't there beforehand, but I've seen plenty of photos and talked to plenty of residents. Apparently, it was a very nice, quiet place to live. When people think of favelas, they think of kind of big, rowdy slums. This was a pretty small community, apparently very safe, very low crime rates. Everyone describes it as a really nice place to live. It's in the Barra da Tijuca neighborhood, which is in the south of Rio, where most of the Olympic stuff is going on. Now it looks like a bomb's hit it, basically. It's just sort of fields of rubble with a few structures here and there where people are hanging on and still living there.
So Maria da Penha was one of the last people in this favela. Where did the rest of her neighbors go?
So there have been various different kind of buyout options where people have been given this option of moving to a local public housing just down the street where there's a swimming pool and a kids' playground and stuff. A lot of people took apartments there. Some people have taken buyouts that have allowed them to go and buy properties elsewhere. And then there's about, I think it's about 50 families or so that are still hanging in there and still in the community.
Was Maria da Penha kind of just hanging on till the very last second, and why was she doing that?
Pretty much. What she's trying to get is she's trying to get the government to promise that some of the people can remain on that land. The government has said that they will build sort of a small housing area for the remaining residents who want to live there. Unfortunately, it's never actually made good on those promises. So when I talked to Maria last week, she said this isn't just about her. This is much more of a symbolic fight, kind of the little man fighting against big government.
É uma luta de direitos. Não, eu não quero, não tô lutando por dinheiro.
She says this is a fight about rights. She's not fighting for money, and she thinks all citizens need to be respected. And that sadly, the society in Brazil, the government, a lot of the time just doesn't respect the rights of humble people, of people who live in communities, in which is the word for favelas in Brazil.
So, Will, you were saying that the government says they're going to build this kind of small piece of property for the Olympics. Have they gotten any more specific about what's going to go into this favela when all the demolition is done?
They really haven't yet. And this is, in many ways, as a fellow reporter mentioned to me, it's kind of a war of information at this point. The residents have been working with local universities to actually draw up some plans of what they want this land to look like, with suggestions making allowances for all the stuff that the government wants to build there. But the government really hasn't come out and said or offered plans and shown pictures of what's going to happen. A little bit after Maria's house was torn down, the government did announce that it would be coming out with plans. So we're going to see them pretty soon. But as Maria de Peña told me, they kind of say one thing and do another. So she says when they do an interview with the media, they say that everything's great, it's all going to be good. But at the end of the day, who's it good for? It's just good for them. And that for humble people like her who live in favelas, it never ends up well.
A woman like Maria de Peña, what does she do for a living, and does she have kind of the resources to create a new life for herself?
I'm not sure exactly what Maria does for a living, but most of these people, I mean, they're really working people, domestic servants. They work in shops and things like that. And the basic answer is no. Rio is a very expensive place to live. These aren't people who've got vast savings that they can go to go and buy a new property. And their main point is that where they were living was very safe. It was a very secure place. And to find somewhere that's safe in Brazil, you've got to go to a nice neighborhood. It's expensive.
So there were evictions happening before the World Cup in 2014 to build the soccer stadiums. Now this is happening again. So it really doesn't sound like Brazil has changed its ways or has really been listening to the people.
They say that they have, that they say that they've made this more open, more transparent. But at the end of the day, the people who are caught up in the middle of this, people like Maria de Peña, say that really what's going on in Vila Autódromo is really indicative of the way the Brazilian government works. She says, and it's not just in my country, but in countries all over the world, where there are mega events like this, the people who end up suffering are the poor.
Will Carlos, a correspondent in Rio with our Global Post team, thanks for telling us about all this and about Maria de Peña's fight.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
You see, but if the system makes it difficult for black men to have jobs, a man without a job cannot really play the role of husband and father. Men work. There was a recent report talking about white men committing suicide, and the number of white males committing suicide has increased. And one of the main reasons they gave for an increase in the number of suicides is white men losing their jobs. See, men have to work to feel like they are really a man.
Earlier this week on The Takeaway, there goes the neighborhood producer Rebecca Carroll joined me. She talked about gentrification, and she said that gentrification is about a lot more than affordable housing and real estate.
We're so behind on that in terms of race and racism, how to talk to each other. And that, to me, is so at the heart of building a neighborhood and a community.
Well, it's an issue in housing, but also at work, how to talk to each other about the things we don't want to talk about, especially when it comes to race. Now, this is one of the issues tackled by Truth Be Told. It's a special radio series from KQED and PRI. And host Joshua Johnson says sometimes personal experiences with racially charged situations are the very hardest ones to talk about.
Those are the ones where we find that you get the most insights out of them. That's why we're taking on those stories in particular, asking listeners to drive the show with their personal stories of racially charged encounters, and then trying to unpack them to figure out what happened and maybe what could have happened differently or better.
Now, you have a character in your first installment. Her name's Annie. I take it Annie's not her real name, right?
She asked us to use her middle name to protect her future career prospects because she's still working in the industry that her story is about.
Okay, now who is Annie and why did you include her?
Annie works in Silicon Valley, got a prospect for a job. A recruiter contacted her, saw her resume on LinkedIn, and apparently made her feel like she was just a shoo-in for this job. So she went into the interview feeling super confident.
Then Annie arrives at her prospective place of work, and let's listen.
the receptionist said, "Now you are," and I mentioned who I was, and she said, "Oh, okay." And the person who was in the office came out, and she looked at me, never said hello, and just started to, she mumbled something, and she was just walking down the corridor. And so I kind of yelled out, "Oh, should I follow you?" And she said, "Oh, yeah, come on."
It seems like she perceived a HR person or whoever was interviewing her was shocked to see her in some way.
Yeah, Annie is African-American. And as she told us the story, it seemed like the people who interviewed her for the job did not expect to be interviewing somebody black.
And so the interview went pretty well. And then Annie actually heard from the recruiter the next day,
saying, "Gosh, I don't know what went wrong. Did things go okay?" I said, "Yeah, I think they went really well." He said, "Because she felt that you were not the right fit."
Joshua, what does that mean?
A lot of people in tech have talked about hiring employees that they feel like they would want to go have a beer with. Now, there is some merit to this because the culture of a Silicon Valley startup is one of the big selling points for new talent. The flip side of it is a number of people of color have said that the right fit often involves people who look like you, who reflect your own worldview. So the issue here is that this idea of the right fit might have meant culture in terms of race and ethnicity.
Well, let's go back to where we began, which is with Annie and what she took away from her experience with this job that she never got.
A lot of things go through your mind. You wonder, gee whiz, was that the reason? But I'm pretty adamant now that I'd much rather have people go to my website, and if they're comfortable, great. And if they're not, wonderful, because then I don't have to waste your time. You don't have to waste mine.
Joshua, she's saying, look at me from a distance first. Make sure you're okay with it before you waste my time. It's unbelievable.
Well, you know, I've talked to a couple people about this, and there's some logic to that. One person I interviewed about Annie's story said that may not be such a bad thing to kind of allow people to confront that bias without you there, before you become part of the interaction. And then once we get in the room, there's the pressure of being the one. You know, tokenism is a real thing. You know, I'm African American, and if I was working in a company where I was the black guy, like me and Willie the janitor, and there was nobody else, the company's efforts to diversify could begin to feel like it's my responsibility, like it's my job to help bring more black people in the company. Some folks are cool with that. Some folks are not. And for an employee of color to move into a space that is predominantly white, all of these issues come up.
Joshua Johnson from KQED, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, Todd. Thank you.
About as funny as a lynching.
Oh, hush, boy. You ain't even see it.
I never seen a lynching either, but I know they not funny.
See? Shows what you know. I've seen funny lynchings.
No, you haven't.
I have, so. Roscoe Patterson's lynching was funny.
Yeah, so them niggas was like, "Roscoe, you better leave time for Mr. Charlie and them rockers gonna fall for you."
I'm like, "Man, fuck these crackers, man. It's Roscoe Patterson. Nigga, I don't give a fuck. I just don't give a fuck. You know what I'm saying? White man can eat a dick. Eat my bowels, nigga."
"There he is! Get that nigga!"
"Oh!
Hey, I got
him! Come on, let's go! Oh, Jesus! Watch out!" It wasn't really funny after that. Mm-mm.
Well, new tonight, Joe's Crab Shack, corporate headquarters, is apologizing for a controversial picture used as part of table decor. This after customers at the Roseville location complained that the picture is racist. Carol Evans' Jay Olstead is live in Roseville with more on this story tonight. Jay?
Yeah, Randy, the restaurant has removed that picture in question, but there are some customers wondering why it was inside this restaurant in the first place.
It was so shocking.
Tyrone Williams and Chantel Allen were celebrating her birthday last night at Joe's Crab Shack in Roseville when they noticed a picture embedded in their table.
So I said, "This is a lynching."
They snapped this picture of the table, which appears to show a large group of white people watching a public execution of at least one black person. On the bottom of the picture, it reads, quote, "Hanging at Groesbeck, Texas on April 12, 1895. At the top, a caption that states, quote, "All I said was I don't like the gumbo."
I'm an African-American studies major, so when I looked at it, it was clear to me that was a lynching.
She and Williams complained to the manager, who they say didn't realize it was there and apologized. Critics call it a double standard.
We would never walk into any franchise establishment and see jokes depicting
images from the Holocaust.
The Minneapolis NAACP is standing with these diners today.
The Minneapolis NAACP today demanded a public apology from the company, Texas-based Ignite Restaurant Group, which owns Joe's Crab Shack. They also want company officials to remove any other pictures that might depict racism in their restaurants across the country. And finally, they're asking the company to make a donation to a local community group
that focuses on African-American youths and teenagers in our community.
Meanwhile, Williams and Allen refused a free meal offered by the restaurant and say they'll never step foot in a Joe's Crab Shack again.
We just felt sick and confused, and it was just sickening. It was disgusting.
Now, the company didn't answer direct questions about whether this picture or a type of picture could be located in other restaurants across the country, but they did apologize in a statement tonight. It reads, in part, "We understand, quote, one of the photos used in our table decor at our Joe's Crab Shack location in Roseville, Minnesota, was offensive. We take this matter very seriously, and the photo in question was immediately removed." Randy?
All right. Thank you, Jay.
See, it used to be we could beat up minorities and nobody cared. It's the reason a lot of us joined the force. Hey, Mitch, you want to go down and arrest some homeless people but not be able to beat up any minorities? No, thank you. Yeah, no, I think we're good.
The city of Chicago is having a bloody year. Already since January, more than 100 people have been murdered there. That is more than double the number at this time last year. This spike in violent crime comes as the police department is under federal investigation, coping with low morale, and searching for a new police chief. But the department is also trying something new. Here's NPR's David Shaper.
It's not Friday Night Lights, it's Friday Night Hoops. Young teenage boys on Chicago's west side are running up and down the floor, dribbling, passing, shooting, and rebounding. It's an intense game.
Get your man.
The coaches in this newly formed basketball league in a park district gym near a public housing development are all Chicago police officers. Officer Paris Edwards explains why.
We've known for quite a while that the relationship between the police and youth has been one that has been strained.
Edwards acknowledges that many of the black teenagers in this neighborhood feel as though police officers only look at them with suspicion. So the goal is to build a little teamwork and trust.
If we can get the youth communicating with these officers, then we could develop some type of relationship outside of them being stopped and questioned for some type of crime.
13-year-old Durante Peterson is one of the star players.
I'm glad they're doing this because, like, right here where we at now, it's a very bad neighborhood. I'm glad that the police came to do this for us.
The effort to improve police-community relations comes at a tough time for Chicago cops. One of the volunteer coaches is 17-year veteran police officer Ron Ruhr.
You know, you got a lot of eyes on you, and a lot of people don't understand the job, and they want to jump to conclusions about what we do or what we're supposed to do.
The scrutiny on Chicago police has intensified since the November release of dash cam video showing Officer Jason Van Dyke firing 16 shots into 17-year-old Laquan McDonald a year earlier. The U.S. Justice Department is conducting a civil rights investigation into the patterns and practices of Chicago police, and it's affecting morale.
Well, morale is poor, to describe it in one word.
Dean Angelo is president of Chicago's Fraternal Order of Police.
It's probably the lowest I've seen in my career.
It's a 15 citywide shots fired, Laramie and Congress. Frank City heard seven shots fired between Congress Parkway and Van Buren.
Calls such as this are going out over Chicago police radios with greater frequency as shootings are up significantly so far this year. This particular incident did not result in any injuries, but there have been more than 450 shooting incidents and more than 100 people murdered in Chicago so far this year. That's more than double the number of both at this point last year.
The majority of it is still gang violence.
Chicago's interim police superintendent, John Escalante.
We're seeing a significant percentage of that gang violence being fueled by social media.
Escalante says social media taunts spark violent responses, which in turn spurs retaliation. But those elements of street violence are not new. What is new is a significant decline in the number of street stops and arrests this year by Chicago police. Street stops are down more than 80% compared to the first 2 months of last year. Arrests are down significantly, too. Escalante acknowledges being concerned about a so-called Laquan McDonald effect, leading to less aggressive policing.
Every officer, I think, not just here in Chicago, but every police officer around the country does not want to be that next viral video.
The interim superintendent recently sent a video message to all 12,000 Chicago police officers emphasizing that those doing their jobs properly don't have to worry. Police Union President Dean Angelo says officers are still diligently doing their jobs, but...
You know, they're damned when they put people on the wall and search them, you know, if they have weapons on them, and now they're being blamed for not putting people on the wall to searching them to see if they have weapons on them.
Angelo says police officers now are walking what he calls a thin blue line between protecting law-abiding citizens and getting lawbreakers off the streets. David Shaper, NPR News, Chicago.
I was in the land of Cam. Oh, signs there are not, forgotten, look away, look away, look away, Dixieland.
Honestly, I hate to see that. Here's a guy throwing punches, nasty as hell, screaming and everything else when we're talking. And he's walking out, and we're not allowed, you know, the guards are very gentle with him. He's walking out like big high fives, smiling, laughing, like to punch him in the face, I'll tell you.
We've never seen a presidential candidate encourage violence, but Trumpism has changed everything. Last night in Fayetteville, North Carolina, local sheriff's deputies decided to order Rakeem Jones to leave a Trump rally just as Donald Trump began speaking. Mr. Jones and his friends fully complied with the sheriff's deputies, who surrounded them as they walked out. And then this happened. That was John McGraw, who reached over to punch Rakeem Jones. Sheriff deputies treated John McGraw as just another happy Trump supporter and allowed him to go back to his seat while they threw Rakeem Jones to the floor and treated him like a criminal. The sheriff deputies then led Rakeem Jones out of the building and no charges were filed until today, when video of what happened appeared on social media and television. Sheriff's deputies then arrested John McGraw and charged him with assault and battery and disorderly conduct. Last month, this is how Donald Trump urged his supporters to treat protesters.
Knock the crap out of them, would you? Seriously. Okay? Just knock the hell. I promise you, I will pay for the legal fees. I promise. I promise.
John McGraw now knows what that promise was worth. He is spending the night in jail tonight, being held on only $2,500 bail, which he apparently cannot afford, and he's not getting a penny of help from Donald Trump. The Trump campaign issued a statement saying, quote, "We are not involved." Thanks to Inside Edition, we know exactly how proud John McGraw was of throwing that punch the night that he did it. A story that is sure to change under oath in a courtroom.
Did you like the event?
You bet I liked it.
Yeah? What'd you like about it?
Knocking the hell out of that big mouth. We don't know who he is, but we know he's not acting like an American.
So you deserved it?
Every bit of it.
What was that?
Yes, he deserved it. The next time we see him, we might have to kill him.
Might have to kill him. Now, where would a Trump supporter ever get an idea like that?
Hey, by the way, I hate some of these people, but I'd never kill them. I hate them. I'll be honest. I would never kill them. I would never do that. No, I wouldn't.
Yes, that was the first time in history that an American presidential candidate discussed killing people who don't agree with him, thought about it on TV for a moment, and then decided not to do it. At least one of his supporters is in jail tonight, still thinking about it. Joining us now, Rakeem Jones, the man who was punched at that Trump rally. Also with us, Ronnie Rouse, who recorded some of the video that you've seen of that incident. Rakeem, could you take us from the beginning and tell us why the sheriff deputies decided you people had to leave the event?
Well, first off, it was more a mixture of words between our group and a group of Trump supporters, and us being the first ones to, I guess, draw attention, it made it bigger than it actually was. And so on our way out, we're getting heckled by the crowd, and Donald Trump himself was in, how can I put this?
Encouraging.
He was encouraging the crowd. He was encouraging the crowd to, you know, jeer, and to encouraging the police to escort me out. And as I was being escorted out, you can see on the video, I was hit.
And Ronnie, were you walking behind Rakim?
I'm in front of him. One in the Carolina jersey, UNC jersey.
Okay, and so what was your, did you feel or sense that kind of danger was present as you were walking up that aisle?
Not at first. I mean, I'm a bigger guy. I'm 6'5". I'm not easily threatened by people. Especially when the police came, it was one of those times where you're like, okay, let's just go along with this. We kind of expected this to happen. And we're not going to bother fighting this. Let's just go and peacefully exit. And the next thing I know, they have Rakim on the ground, you know? And it's just crazy because all these police were around him while he was struck. And they're throwing him on the ground and telling the guy to go have a seat.
And, Ronnie, when you say they're telling the guy to go have a seat, they knew, it sounds to me, what you're saying is they knew that's the guy who threw the punch.
There was an officer behind us, one beside us, and at least six in front of us. They were escorting us out. And after Rakim got struck, they told the guy to sit down, and they threw Rakim on the ground. And you would think Rakim was the one who threw the first punch, you know. And we were reading an article earlier. They were saying that he may have fell up the steps, or he may have tripped. In so many words, the steps lead to a top of a pavilion where it's flat. We were on the flat part. There's nothing to trip up after they hip tossed him.
And Rakim, the guy who threw the punch at you, is now behind bars. But we heard him say on video, without any reluctance, after that event, talking to Inside Edition, that maybe next time he would have to kill you. What is it like for you to hear somebody like that saying something like that?
It's kind of scary, seeing as I have a family who's out here, and I feel for more of their safety than my own.
And Ronnie, when you see that guy talking on the video, that's a glimpse inside Trump supporters that we haven't seen before, that kind of candid comment about the whole thing and how glad he was to have done it. Does that surprise you, or when you were there and you're in a crowd like that and you're wondering what people think, if someone came along and told you that, is that beyond what you imagine some of these people might be thinking?
No. The main thing I was shocked about, I said in previous interviews, is that where we live at is Fort Bragg. That's next to us. It's the biggest military installation in the United States. We're a very diverse, cultured city. And we watched a lot of these other events, these campaign events, happen in other cities in the Bible Belt in the South that are more racially charged areas historically. And we knew it wasn't going to happen in Fayetteville. And we went to spectate, and it happened to us in front of law enforcement. And I felt like we took three steps back. It was the first time I was embarrassed to tell people I was from Fayetteville.
And Rakim, when the police surrounded you and were escorting you out, at that point, did you at least feel, well, I mean, at least we're safe now, the police are escorting us out?
To be honest, I really didn't understand the force. You can escort me out, you can walk, but the force.
They were in mass. It was 10, 12 officers walking us out. We felt like we were a presidential candidate. That's what you would think. You would think we were the candidate getting walked out of the Crown Coliseum.
Rakeem Jones, I'm very sorry this happened to you. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. Ronnie Rouse, thank you for capturing that video and making it available. Thank you both. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
If you don't like her, you send her back.
Yeah, you tell her you didn't like her performance because she was white.
What? That's not the point.
Flipper, she's been here for 5 minutes. Give her a chance. This sounds dangerously like reverse discrimination to me.
What?
Today, UAlbany held a student conduct hearing for the three women at the center of the CDTA bus incident that we've been talking so much about. The women initially claimed to be victims of a racial attack, but were charged after surveillance video showed a different story playing out. And during the hearing, university administration reviewed violations to the student code of conduct. News 10 ABC's Samantha Damasio, not inside the hearing. She was not allowed inside. She did talk with people who have been protesting. Sam.
Yeah, Christina, things have quieted down here now, but earlier UAlbany police spent much of their morning here outside Liberty Terrace, where that controversial and closed academic hearing got underway inside. There are barricades set up here. No one was allowed in, including, like you mentioned, us and a group of protesters. Those protesters arguing that the university should have waited until the judicial process was complete before they made any determinations of whether the students violated the code of conduct. Protesters say the three women would not be able to present a defense at this hearing because of the pending criminal charges, and to expect them to do so would infringe on their constitutional right to remain silent. We spoke with a former attorney and current criminal justice professor here at the university who tells me the administration does have an independent interest in figuring out if a serious incident did happen involving their students, and if so, what disciplinary response is necessary. He says there's no way of knowing how long the judicial process would take.
To wait until the criminal process runs its course could be, for all we know, you know, the semester's gone and there's a several month separation between the incident and a determination about who did it or whether it happened at all.
The defendants are not permitted.
The defendants are not permitted
to have legal representation participate.
To have legal representation participate
in this hearing.
In this.
And lawyers for Aisha Burwell and Ariel Aquino tell us that their clients were not here today. I was not able to get in touch with Alexis Briggs, but those lawyers saying that they're not here for those same exact reasons those protesters were talking about today. Regardless, we're told by the university that the proceedings would go on with or without those defendants here today. Anya Tucker will have more on this story coming up in later editions of News 10 ABC. But for now, we're live on the campus of UAlbany. Samantha Damasio, News 10 ABC.
Remember, no one is going to treat you special just because you are black.
The dean of Harvard Law School endorsed a recommendation to change the school's official shield because it contains the crest of Isaac Royal, a slave owner whose endowment of land helped establish the school. The recommendation came from a committee appointed by the dean, but it was also one of several demands from a student group calling itself Reclaim Harvard Law, an organization that was part of a wave of protest movements that developed on campuses across the country last fall. Members of the group who've been occupying a student center for weeks applaud the shield recommendation, but they also say it's not enough. For NPR's Code Switch team, Arun Roth reports.
The dozens of protesters who have occupied the student center since February haven't clashed with campus security or barricaded themselves inside, though there are some sleeping bags and chairs pushed together for the protesters camped out here. They hold discussion groups and invite guest speakers. On a recent night, you could hear Arab-American comedian Amr Zar riffing on the census form.
Then there's a box that says Asian. Now, Arabs were Asian. But we know they don't mean us, and they tell you that they don't mean us. They write a whole list of examples. Korean, Japanese, Filipino, Vietnamese, Chinese, which sounds like the greatest food court ever.
In addition to doing stand-up, Zar is also a professor of law at the Detroit Mercy School, teaching a class in critical race theory. That's something members of Reclaim Harvard Law School, like Keaton Allen Gassessa, want to hear in the classroom.
We've been asking for critical race theorists to come here to be a part of the faculty, and those calls have gone ignored, and so we've been able to bring some here.
Racism at Harvard Law School became a national headline last November when a vandal defaced the photographs of African-American professors, putting black tape over their faces. But the students in the Reclaim movement are most passionate about institutional changes, such as further diversifying the faculty. Student Cameron Clark tells a joke that circulated among students of color after the tape incident.
They didn't need much black tape to cover up the faces of our black professors, you know?
Clark says that prior to the occupation, Reclaim had meetings with the dean of the law school, Martha Minow, and Marcia Sells, the dean of students.
And we went line by line on all of the different demands that we had. We were met with platitudes. We weren't really met with a definitive yes or no on any or all of them.
The detailed list of demands include changes to the curriculum and faculty, new committees and offices that address diversity and inclusion, and making the school more affordable for disadvantaged students. Here's Dean Marcia Sells.
The reality is many of them are things that students have been talking about for a while, so we're not, you know, looking at it from the context of we have to respond to demands, but we are looking at here are the things we have been doing.
Dean Sells points to the school hiring a director for community engagement and equity, conducting a comprehensive study of the climate on campus, and strengthening diversity training, among other things. Reclaim has not been satisfied with the response so far, and last month they occupied the student center. But a lot of students don't agree with the agenda of the Reclaim movement or their tactics. Sarah Gitlin is a third-year student and a self-described progressive who believes in racial justice. But she thinks Reclaim is going about it the wrong way.
Instead of working with the administration, Reclaim has been fighting them, has been creating a really antagonistic environment. And so I think that a lot of students who are uncomfortable with certain portions of Reclaim are genuinely afraid to speak out about it. And at a law school that's devoted to a marketplace of ideas, that's a real shame.
Right now, no one sees an end in sight to the protest. Reclaim Harvard Law School says the occupation of the student center will continue until their demands are met, and Dean Sells says the administration has no intention of kicking them out. Arun Roth, NPR News, Boston.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
Students and families in Forest Grove are taking a stand tonight after a student hurled a racial slur at a high school teacher. Fox 12's Jamie Wilson joins us live from Forest Grove with the controversy. Jamie?
Well, Amy, district officials tell us that it happened on Tuesday in between classes here at Forest Grove High School. The teacher on the receiving end is black. It's her first year teaching here, and students say that she nor anyone else in this community should have to tolerate such comments.
She began to speak and talk, but she didn't say hello to any of us or in the morning or anything. You could tell she was visibly upset.
Max Kimberly says the minute he sat down in language arts on Tuesday, he knew something was wrong with his teacher, Maisha Harville. Ms. Harville explained that a student just passed by her classroom door and called her the N-word. Then she left. Max says everyone was speechless.
I just thought that we can't stand for this anymore. The people at our school, we need to stand up for each other, and especially someone that's such a wonderful teacher, someone that's respected in our community, can't have this happen.
School leaders say other students heard the racial slur. They tracked down the student and brought him to the office. In a statement from Principal Karen O'Neill, harassment of any kind against students or teachers will not be tolerated on campus. Teens we talked to agree that this is disturbing, but say it's not uncommon.
I think it's being stupid and just trying to be funny out there, you know, in front of their friends. That's my opinion.
It does happen. Definitely more than you ever want to imagine it happens. And we're kind of hoping that that's something we're going to be able to combat and that we're going to use this as a little bit of a platform and be like, hey, this is why it's unacceptable. You know, it really does hurt people.
Officials won't comment on specifics, but they say the student in question is being disciplined. But that's not good enough for Max. He started a petition on change.org calling for strict action from the district and for the student to be expelled. Nearly 700 people have signed it.
It's her first year, but as you can see on the petition, she's touched so many people.
Max says Ms. Harville was absent yesterday, but today she came back. And she is grateful for all the support she's getting.
She came up to me and she thanked me and told me that this was very big and that a lot of people weren't prepared to do what I was going to do.
Now, we put in a request to speak with Ms. Harville, but have not heard back from her quite yet. Now, some people have heard, and there are rumors that she is leaving because of this incident. We have not heard anything about that, and district officials say that is not the case. Some of her students tell us that she was only planning on teaching here in Forest Grove for 1 year, but again, she has not confirmed that with us. Live in Forest Grove tonight, Jamie Wilson, Fox 12, Oregon.
I'm not sure anymore just how it happened before. The places that I knew were sunny and blue. I can feel it deep inside, this black nigger's pride. I have no fear when I say, and I say it every day, every nigga is a star. Every nigga is a star. Who will deny that you and I and every nigga is a star?
New at 11, an apparent case of road rage in Richmond. A local man says he was taking his six-year-old to school when he was rammed by an irate driver who threatened him with a machete and racial slurs. Chris Thomas live tonight with more on this disturbing case. Chris, the victim says he was hit on the front side of his car and then followed the driver.
That's exactly right, Kurt. As a matter of fact, he says he hit it right around this area in the front side of his car. And so he ran after the driver, but he got a big surprise. Take a look.
I woke up to take my son to school. That
and
was simply it.
Ended up with your car smashed.
Smashed.
Take a closer look. Kelvin Hurdle says this is the result of a hit and run, and so he followed the driver.
Once he got out of the vehicle, he had a machete in his hand, about 2 feet long machete in his hand, waving it, stating that he was going to kill me and my son, and that he should have killed us back there on the road.
Hurdle snapped this photo, and there you see what appears to be a long knife. He called police, who he claims told him to fill out this crash information form. He also took out a protective order.
I wouldn't have had to take a protective order out on him if the police never gave him my information, my address, where to actually physically come and find me. You know, like, I'm scared for my life.
So let me bring you up to speed on what I've learned from police. I got this statement saying this appears to be a road rage incident. An accident report was taken, but the officer was unable to determine fault. There were no third-party witnesses to the threat of bodily harm. As a result, the officer recommended the option of taking out warrants with the magistrate. Citizens can always file a complaint if they feel an officer has not handled a situation appropriately.
The last thing you do is follow that person and confront them yourself, because you don't know what they're capable of.
Hurdle says he's left with $800 in damage to his car.
And when that happens, what a citizen should do is get the license plate number of the vehicle and immediately report it to the police.
Instead, one driver could face several charges.
Potential charge of brandishing a machete, potential charge of assault.
While the other is afraid to even drive again.
I'm not safe here, you know, it's just not right.
Now, late tonight, I got a message from police saying they plan to have a meeting with the victim. In this case, we'll keep you posted on how this story develops. For now, on your side, Chris Thomas, NBC 12 News.
And every nigga is a star. Every nigga is a star. Who will deny that you and I and every nigga is a star. Every nigga's a star. Every nigga's a star. Every nigga's a star. Yes, every nigger is a star. Every nigger's a star. A superstar, superstar. Every nigger's a star.
Begin this morning in the Metro East, tracking the search for the driver accused of leaving an 11-year-old boy for dead after a hit-and-run crash.
East St. Louis police are telling us that Maurice Richards was crossing the street when he was hit by a car. He later died at the hospital, and News 4's Justin Andrews now tracking this investigation with the Bomarito Street Fleet joining us live from our Illinois newsroom in Belleville. Justin, the details of this story, very disturbing.
Emily, it really is. What makes this even more painful is that detectives in East St. Louis tell us several cars drove by the boy and didn't even stop to help. Now, this is where police say the hit and run took place, in the area of State Street and Post Place in East St. Louis. We're told he was just crossing the street around 6:30 yesterday evening when a driver hit him and kept going. It took between 5 to 10 minutes before someone finally stopped and called 911. And it's that part of the story that hurts, even for detectives working this case.
Senseless act, and, you know, as citizens of this city, we have to do better because no one will protect it like us. So if you were one of the ones that seen the young man land in the street and went around him, you know, it's not right.
Now, little Maurice was rushed to the hospital where he was later pronounced dead. There is no car description or a description of the suspect. So this morning, East St. Louis police, they are pleading with the public, asking anyone to come forward if they have any information on who hit this young boy. Again, they are hoping that this will help bring justice if they find whoever did this. We're live from outside of our Illinois newsroom. I'm Justin Andrews, News 4.
Black babies cost less.
Context of white supremacy, Gus T. Renegade, in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, March 12th, 2016. So, I have been told. Compensatory call-in, feel free, chime in if you have thoughts you would like to share. The number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. That number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. We are fundraising 2016. Invest if you think the program is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. Listener supported Counter Racist Radio. If you are not into PayPal, drop me an email. We'll get you a physical mailing address. If that is not a problem, you will see the PayPal button in the top right corner of the blog. Thanks to all the folks who have invested, supported us 7 years plus. Hope the program has been, continues to be, worthy of your time and energy. Quickly, before we get to folks, if they have commentary they would like to share, just again want to emphasize we should always be striving for accuracy. That's one thing right there. People always talk about things that we can do to work against racism, white supremacy, to the best of our ability. Strive for accuracy. That is certainly difficult in an environment that is saturated with incorrect information and racists being deliberately deceptive in how they present quote-unquote information, that's which is not even what it is, but really make an effort to strive for accuracy. That's something I appreciate, even with listeners. They let me know if I've got something incorrect. I think last week when I said the Virginia State song, that they still didn't have one, and they just changed it up last year where they now have two. Thomas calling in to see if we get clarification about the Brooklyn rape case from just a few weeks ago, if they were indeed white people or not. We should always really want to make sure that we're striving for accuracy. That alone does a lot to work against racism, white supremacy. One of the other quick details I wanted to make sure that we got in, I think Dr. Frances Kress-Welsing, she would say consistently, reading is more important than watching television. That was one of the things that she emphasized over and over and over again through her many visits on the program. When we read Ben Tillman and the Reconstruction of White Supremacy, I said then that it was not the funnest read, right? You're talking about things that happened about 150 years, more than that, really, from the 19th century. And you know, it's kind of moldy old language and what have you, hearing about what these folks did way back when. But, I mean, that is so important for context and getting a much deeper understanding for why things are the way that they are, and just being able to put things in perspective so we are not confused, so that we have much greater clarity about what it means to be white. I think I have frequently quoted from the book one of the lines that I have chuckled about and is most memorable for me, when Ben Tillman, former governor of South Carolina, when he says, the threat of Negro domination hangs over us like the sword of Damocles. That is a funny line and important, because I think you still see a lot of those same types of sentiments from whites. And, you know, we got to make sure we do these things for our niggers to get out of control. But really, the most important line, in my view, in the book is on page 260. All everything that's happening with Donald. Really, you can pick any of the clips that you heard. Pick anything at random. The quote that he has on page 260 of that book, where Mr. Tillman, where he says, former U.S. Senator as well, where he says, if you scratch the white man too deep, you will find the same savage whose ancestry used to roam wild in Britain. Straight from the lips of Ben Tillman. Statue still stands. They took down the Confederate flag. They did not take down Ben Tillman statue in South Carolina. Also wanted to make sure I got in. You heard Dr. Yaba Blay. She's been a guest on the program before. She gave a fantastic advertisement for the context of white supremacy in her interview. I had so many thoughts because she did almost an hour interview on North Carolina Public Radio this week. And I was dejected at first. I was like, oh, man, she couldn't hang out with us for an hour. Like, man, she hung out with them for an hour. They, you know, that is not cool. But when I was listening to the interview, the first 15, 20 minutes where they're talking about her growing up in New Orleans and what they call colorism and you're so black and you can't come to my birthday party and blah, 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 all this other stuff. And I said, man, that is a major, at least in my view. And when I was thinking about it, I was thinking because it was a white person, Frank Stacio, Dr. Kanban, Kamal Kanban, has talked about him before. He's a North Carolina resident as well. And he said, man, this guy practices racism in a variety of different ways, regardless of what they're talking about. I guess he listens to his program on a regular basis. He's on his assignment. But I was listening and I was like, man, this conversation, yes, black people do these things in terms of critiquing each other. You're too dark and I don't want to hang around you. You're black. Get back. Yes, absolutely. That's long running. All of that is a product of white people, white supremacy. But that was not how the conversation was grounded, that whites are to blame for all of this, what they call the Creole culture in New Orleans and how black people behave there or anywhere else in the world, that all of this, whites, racists are most responsible for this. And the conversation was not grounded in that. It took about 20, maybe even 30 minutes into their dialogue before it got to what is the context for all of this? And then she dropped, bam, context, context, context. And she even said the whole title of the program, Context of White Supremacy. Right on. Thank you for the commercial and great job. I said that just that snippet right there, I thought was another great illustration of why this program is titled as it is. In fact, I think quite a number of guests, both when they have been on this program and just out in general discussion where they're out talking wherever they are about racism, context comes up all the time. I mean, I could put like a Hall of Fame clip together of people emphasizing context, including President Obama, Neely Fuller, Dr. Kamal Kanban, Dr. Blay, Dr. Welsing, Mark Lamont Hill. He was on Huffington Post and they were talking about Renisha McBride. And he said the whole title of the program, Context of White Supremacy. So many people, they have emphasized and done a brilliant job of just adding further understanding logic as to why this program is titled what it is and the importance of logic. With that, I will leave it there. I had a few other items, but I will just sprinkle them in as we roll. If folks that dialed in, if you could remember to please watch the background noise, that would be super appreciated. If you could share one time, everybody, if you could take about 5 minutes, whatever you want to share, that way we can get everybody in. And then if we have extra time, folks can, whatever other extra comments, questions you want to make sure you add in, just to make sure we give everyone an opportunity to share for the Saturday program. And just, again, striving for accuracy, the Saturday program, compensatory call-in, no metaphors, please. Gus did not say we should never use metaphors. I use metaphors. I think everyone uses metaphors. They can be helpful tools to explain. However, what I have noted consistently when people begin to talk about racism, and I think some of this is just because we are all still confused, non-white people I'm talking about, non-white people are still confused, including Gus T. Renegade, about what racism is and how it works. And I think the danger is that when you begin to use metaphors in describing something that you are still trying, learning about, seeking clarity, sometimes you can pick metaphors that do not accurately reflect what it is that you're trying to describe, what it is that you're trying to compare. And that happens a lot when people are discussing racism, white supremacy. They pick metaphors where you're comparing things that are not equivalent. It happens all the time. In addition to a lot, there are a myriad of problems as to why I really encourage folks, even if you're going to use metaphors, I know people continue to do so, that you should really be careful, monitor when people are using metaphors, inspect them to see if they're accurate, to see if what is being presented makes sense, if the two things being compared are even equivalent. You should really do a lot. Make sure that your logic is functioning at a high level, because it happens all the time. And a lot of times these metaphors, they are designed to get you more emotionally invested in what's being said, as opposed to stopping. I'm going to think about this to make sure it makes sense, what is being presented. So it's very, very important. That's why I really encourage the Saturday program. We're supposed to be doing a better job of, you know, being mindful of what we say, how we say it when articulating racism. So all of us, I said last week, I'm going to challenge myself to call that out more frequently when people do use metaphors on the program. I do it for myself when I make an error and use metaphors on the Saturday program. So definitely be doing it for listeners. And folks did a fantastic job last week when I emphasized that. People did a much, much better job of just being careful and just watching what we say, which we should be doing as a part of our counter-racist effort. So thank you. No metaphors for the Saturday program. With that, feel free, chime in. I will kind of nab the first portion of people who called in, who have questions or comments, and I'll just kind of nab people in groups as we go through. So the first five or so people that dialed in with a hand up, your line should be open. If you all had commentary, your line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Just a few things. About the clip with Brazil, I didn't really like the way that they said it, and this is another form of confusion, that it's simply the way Brazil works. It's how white supremacy works, because unless I didn't hear the clip clearly, they didn't bring up the racial dynamic that much. And what's interesting about Brazil is that something similar happened in, I think I might have mentioned this on the program a few weeks ago, but in Canada, in particular in Nova Scotia, Halifax, Nova Scotia, we have an incident several decades ago where the black community of Africville, folks were actually forced to move out, and they actually, the Nova Scotia government made it a dumping site and forced people out of there. And one of the things, there's a documentary about it, one of the elderly women in the documentary mentioned that one of the things that the government didn't like is that they were independent. So it was just very interesting to me. It just reminded me of that. And now to the clip about tech, I don't really like in racism, discussions about racism, when it's reduced strictly to personal stories and bias, because I find that it just creates more confusion upon confusion. And it's, again, we keep not wanting to see white supremacy as a system. And going to the Joe's Crab Shack incident, I think it's a very important incident because it shows that white supremacy, again, another of the bajillion examples you can draw from, that white supremacy is a culture. And this silliness about the manager saying he didn't know the sign was there. This is just silly, white, ignorant stuff. But I like that the Williams couple, if I'm saying their last name right, refused to eat there even when they tried to compensate them. I think that we should encourage, in instances like these, supporting Black cuisine or Black takeout, Black things, getting away from going to those stores. So I kind of like what they said there. And the clip with the officers and the youth, I think that was just really disgusting, manipulative confusion technique. The problem isn't communicating and understanding. It's just simply white supremacy. There's no communication understanding that's going to change white officers from being racist. And the clips on the Trump soldier, I just think that this whole discussion of Trump, it goes back to what Sabrina Johnson was saying when I asked her that question. We keep seeing Trump supporters as the racist and all other white people are good. This really bothers me. And yeah, that's about it. That's all I have to know.
Said last week, I'm trying to come up with a... Yes, sir. I just wanted to get in. I said last week that I think we should come up with a term for that in terms of whites skillfully trying to reduce or constrict the individuals who are racist to a small number, to say that these whites over here, whether it's the Trump supporters or conservatives, Republicans, the Klan, whatever they do, but it's just these limited whites over here, they are the racist, and all of us other white folks, we're cool. We're not racist. We're on you Negro's side. It's just these whites over here. I think that is a skillful tactic that's been used a lot. We should have a specific term for that. The person that spoke up who wanted to comment?
Yeah, yes, sir. I'm a caller from Connecticut. I'm a first-time caller, and I'm a long-time listener. I'm a little bit nervous, but, you know, I use my my iTunes account, and, you know, I started all the way from the bottom, man, and I got a very, very good understanding of how white people behave, man. I was just going to say, I was just going to ask the question of when is the session on workplace racism held? Because I forgot.
It's this program. It's the last hour. So this is the second hour of the program. So the last hour is workplace racism. So you can just stay tuned. If you would like to go first for workplace racism, you can do so.
Okay, yeah, because I have, I have something out. But yeah, other than that, I was just going to comment on that. I had to leave my notes. I left my notes inside. I had to come out to my car because the company that one of my roommates had was a white female. So I had to leave my notes on my computer while my computer was charging some of my car now. But I was just going to comment on the picture on the Joe's Crab Shack. And the shield, there was like some shield you were speaking of, or some clip was playing. And then the teacher, all three of those things, first dealing with the pitcher in Joe's Crab Shack and the shield. Like I'm always like hearing, like, we plan on, taking this image down. We plan on removing it. And I remember Gus, like, every now and then, like, I'll hear you and, you'll be speaking on stuff like this and you'll say, leave those images up, I totally agree with that. So I believe, you should leave the images up because I think, in my personal opinion, that if you take the images down, that's kind of, throwing away history. And, I don't know. I just think they should just leave the images and pictures in there. And that's all. I'll mute my line.
Appreciate it. First time caller. Other folks that we have not heard from yet, your line should be open.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Gus, for the program today. Good evening to everyone here today. I am still learning. I have concluded that black people problems are white people. White people lie to black people in all areas of people activity. White people are serious about being serious about practicing racism, white supremacy. Black people have to practice self-respect and self-respect with each other. Black people have to stay focused on a code of thought, speech, and action, and an emotional response over and over and over and over again to replace racism with white, to replace racism, white supremacy with justice, because our lives are in jeopardy. Gus, I'd like to do the prayer this evening.
Yes, sir. That should not be a problem.
Thank you. No further comment right now.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you, Gus. Excuse me, and to all the callers and listeners. This is Ross, and I thought about what you were saying in reference to trying to come up with a term for when whites try to point non-white people in a specific direction as far as who is racist, as far as which white people are racist versus those that are supposedly good whites. And something just came to me, attention misdirection, because that's essentially what they're doing, is they're trying to force you to look in a specific direction while the sleight of hand is being done by the people that you're not paying attention to, under the assumption that somehow they're better whites than the whites that are overtly racist or white supremacists. I don't know if that works, but it's something that came to me. As far as the clip with Dr. Yabablay, I thought it was really brilliant. I caught the her use of the term context of white supremacy, and I thought it was just brilliant. It was like a nuclear bomb in the middle of the conversation. It just brought everything right to where it needed to be.
Metaphor.
And I'm sorry. Oh, let me rewind it. I just thought the way that she used it, or when she used the term, I just thought that it was something that really brought your attention to exactly where it needed to be, which was racism, white supremacy. So I thought it was really brilliant that she did that. And the clip, the brief clip that you played with Neely Fuller Jr. Speaking about keeping people on the move, non-white people, that is, on the move and not allowing them to settle, really just is a cornerstone of white supremacy, because people who are not settled cannot take time to think about anything other than whatever their daily reality is, whether it is trying to save their home or just survive on a daily basis. And then, of course, being forcibly removed, whether it's by raising the prices in an area or gentrification or whatever other means they choose to do so, essentially keeps you from being able to focus on anything except what they're putting in front of you. And as a result, you're not able to focus on, again, the problem, racism, white supremacy. The clip you played about the Donald Trump rally, just again kind of reinforces the legacy, the Ben Tillman legacy of violence happening at these events. I thought it would be very strange for any black person to be attracted to any sort of rally for any Republicans, Democrats. I just think any of those places are dangerous places for black people, just looking at the history of those events and reading books like Ben Tillman and seeing the things that used to take place at these events. So I found it interesting that they even wanted to go, but they said they wanted to just kind of go, I guess, to spectate. And also, I found it interesting because the white supremacist police officers kind of did the superorganism routine as far as them telling the perpetrators, as far as the person who assaulted Mr. Rakeem Jones, I think was his name, they told them to sit down rather than actually arresting them, and then assaulted the victim. So to me, it was just their super organism mentality, where they have to protect their own at all times and mistreat a non-white person, even when that person is innocent. The teacher being called a nigger by the student in the school she was teaching just really speaks to the fact that all white people are racist, white supremacists, no matter what age they are. And essentially they learn at a very young age to mistreat non-white people. The one about the machete attack on the black male really just brought me back to the show that you did where you talk about white people can ruin your life in about 5 minutes, and you say that fairly regularly. It's just proof positive that that's exactly what it is. These people are dangerous. They're like unleashed predators, and we have to be very careful. And when you made the comment about Ben Tillman, the Ben Tillman comment about page 260 in the book, where he speaks about the savage being just under the surface, and if you scratch, scratch them, that you'll get that savage that used to run in the frontiers of Britain, really reminds me of their propensity of making vampire films and werewolf films, because the premise of the film is that even though these people live amongst normal human beings, there is a savage right there at all times that can come out and assault you, attack you, or kill you at any given moment. And that is exactly what dealing with white people is on a daily basis. A lot of the clips you played tonight, especially the one about Rakeem Jones and the guy who was chased with the machete, essentially speaks to the fact that no matter how quote-unquote nice they are or pleasant they are, or if they give you something or help you financially, that just beneath the surface there is a dangerous, predatory savage that can take your life in no time flat and then walk away from the judicial system with a free pass for doing it. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. We can hear you.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers. Roz, gentleman who asked to do the prayer, calling Connecticut, new caller, and calling Canada and everyone else who's on the line. You're calling Connecticut, man. You're good, man. I don't let white people in my house. In no circumstances, they got to have a lease or a warrant. I don't do that, man. But I just want to say, Gus, I'm glad you pointed out the Tillman book, because that's when I started making that association between Trump and Tillman. And that's what really got me into paying attention as this has gone on. And I mean, we did that book a long time ago. And, you know, I watched the political theater to make counter-racist observations, but I do not advocate, vote in, or participate in politics with black people or discussing politics with white people. When white people are talking politics, that is question time and quiet time. Listen. You know, we got to study the white people. That's why I watched it. And, you know, Gus, if Trump is president, I think you'll have Rush Limbaugh-type numbers because from what I've seen this week, it's been pretty amazing. And, you know, I couldn't believe it. This week, the Democrats had a debate with all Latino and Hispanic people. And I was like, wow, you know, it's sort of nauseating. Because as much as we or black people support the Democrats regardless of what they're running for, I've never seen a debate where they came to, you know, the Apollo or something and was asking black, letting black people stand up and ask questions. So just wow, you know, I think people should pay attention to that. You know, they flat out asked both Bernie Sanders and Hillary if Trump was a racist, and Spanish first, of course. And neither Bernie nor Hillary vote cold. Neither answered the question with a yes or a no, which automatically, in my opinion, qualifies both of them as dangerous white supremacists. Also, all this talk about Trump being a racist, but the media, no media outlets are focusing on the millions of white people who have voted for him so far. Millions. And color change. They keep sending me emails to register and vote against Trump, and also to petition for Coca-Cola to stop sponsoring Trump events. And it's kind of strange because I would be like, why don't you just say to boycott Coca-Cola if that's the point? I wish people would stop going, black people would stop going to Trump events, stop going to his events protesting. Let the white people do that. You know, this is observation time, not participation time. Tonight, during his speech that ended at 9 o'clock, right before the show came on, it was interrupted dozens of times until he ordered the police to stop releasing the people outside and to arrest them. And he would personally go and press charges and guarantee that he'll ruin their lives with a criminal record. Now, I didn't see nobody else start protesting after that. Also, I saw a black male get pepper sprayed outside of the event, and that was in Kansas City that just ended at 9 o'clock. Last week, it was a gentleman, a young man in Oakland. He called in, and he was talking about the definition of black and white. And you know, I looked up the synonyms of black, and it describes white people to a T. I don't know if that was a metaphor. I'm sorry. It describes white people perfectly. But a few of them was terrible, darkness, evil, disgraceful, sinister, and fatal. Whites have given this name to us. We call ourselves black, just like before our people called ourselves Negro or colored and nigger. So my question to him, and anyone else, but to him since he's young, is does he think that it's being that black automatically, psychologically, you associate with those negative words? Does he think that it's a good idea for us to keep calling ourselves black people? And is it a good idea for us to call these people white people, being that the metaphors for that are so great? That was my question for him. The lady called in on the show with Dr. Welsman's protege and referred to the system of white supremacy as witchcraft and evil. And I just want to say I don't agree. I think that's similar to when white people are referred to as crazy and sick. Practicing witchcraft and being evil are totally legal in the United States. Church of Satan is a government-protected, tax-exempt organization. In the name of justice, we should be referring to this as criminal activities always, terrorism, murder, rape, extortion, kidnapping, slavery, not, biblical fiction of evil or fairy tale fiction or witchcraft. Neither is a crime. And just to add very quickly, Just Say No. Of course, it wasn't strong enough. I mean, like I said, it was on the candy. I mean, it wasn't strong enough. And, they don't have no Just Say No campaign with all these white people on heroin. Now there's a Change the Law campaign, Let's Make It Legal campaign, not a Just Say No campaign. In Brazil, I heard these same stories during the World Cup. And, I hate to say it, it's like they're playing games with the Brazilian people. I mean, they're being dislocated for stadiums. I did have a workplace racism story to add. It was kind of came up as a memory. Something I wouldn't even thought of, and I'll add it later. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, sir. Other folks who we have not heard from yet, if you had commentary, your line should be open.
Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for taking my call. Hope you all are trying to have the best evening you can. A couple of comments with the shield. Something similar happened here at school. Some people put up something for Women's History Month where I live in the little dorm area, and they had various women. One was Cleopatra, and it was clearly Elizabeth Taylor. So I had to point that out. I said, they're young black girls and boys that live around here, we don't want to give them incorrect information. And I did point that out to a black person because the resident director here is black, and I don't want to, run and tell the white people because, we don't want to do that. We want to try to handle our problems and us within ourselves. And also, I think someone was talking about a name. I don't know why we can't call them all Trump supporters, or if you want to, you can call them Sterling, like Donald Sterling. Oh, that's a Sterling statement, because Sterling means pure, and it's probably almost pure racist, what they're saying. So you can just say Sterling, and they'll think it's good, and we know what it means. Thank you. That's all.
Right on. Right on. Let's see. Other folks that have dialed in with a hand up, if we have not heard from you, your line should be open.
Hi, this is Sunny from L.A., and I was interested in talking about the story, the article. The first one had to do with drug. Just Say No is the story. Columbia professor, I thought, did a really good job in expressing that saying Just No is a good concept, but also within the context of the racism, white supremacy, terrorism system, that jobs, employment, education are also factors, and that is the context of in which a lot of drug abuse happens. The fact that we don't have, as black people, jobs to support us, which often leaves us and our families in dire straits and on the path of drugs and drug abuse. But in response to that, I have an article that HHS, it's Health and Human Services, it's a federal agency, awarded $94 million to health centers to help treat the prescription opioid abuse and heroin epidemic in America. And the purpose of this funding is to improve and expand the delivery of substance abuse services in health centers with a specific focus on treatment of opioid use disorders. And just paying attention to the language that's used in the memorandum, that the public health of the opioid epidemic is one of the most pressing public health issues in the United States, said Secretary Burwell. And this funding is going to have expanding access to medication-assisted treatment, not prison. These services will be integrated into health centers to bolster nationwide efforts to curb opioid abuse and misuse. The abuse and addiction of opioids such as heroin, prescription pain medications is a increasing, quote, public health problem. Quickly here it says the funding, the $94 million, will assist in providing training and education resources to help health professionals make informed prescribing decisions. So that's part of the funding. Also, the health centers will be on the forefront of the fight against opioid abuse. And the research demonstrates that a whole patient approach to treatment through a combination of medication and counseling and behavioral therapies is most successful in treating opioid use disorders. And finally, I just wanted to say that this affirms, this is another bullet point here, but affirms the importance of behavioral health to overall health, and that addressing the opioid crisis is a top priority for the administration and the department. In addition, the president has made addressing the prescription opioid abuse and heroin epidemic a top priority and issued a presidential memorandum last year on improving access to medication-assisted treatment for opioid use, quote-unquote, disorders. Building on these efforts, about a half a minute more, building on these efforts, the president's budget includes a $1.1 billion initiative to help ensure that all individuals with opioid use disorders want treatment are able to access it. My issue here is that I find that the percentage of white young people who are now addicted to and misusing, abusing this opiate, Oxycontin, et cetera, is a concern for the United States and the system of racism, white supremacy. I submit that this funding is to save their children. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Folks can check out Chasing Heroin documentary they just released on PBS. They've been talking about this for a long, long time now, but that's just another effort. You can see a lot of that, the white faces that they present for you to empathize with. Other folks that we have not heard from, your line should be open.
Hello?
Yes, sir, M1. Your volume is a little low. If you could speak up, please.
Okay. Yes, I'll be quick. First of all, good evening to everyone. I just wanted to say I just read this week Derek Stafford is a, I forgot, one of the two black Louisiana police officers that were immediately arrested and charged with murder, attempted murder, for killing a little white boy and wounding his dad. Well, he finally is out of prison after 4 months. Now, as I said before, I appreciate the fact that his wife said if he and his partner were white, they would not be charged. But more importantly, were the fact that his police union representatives allow him to stay, you know, didn't let him stay and let him be locked up behind bars for 4 months, because we know police departments have large coffers. So this should not have even been the case. And there wasn't any GoFundMe Dan Wilson type money for this officer either. Now, as for the black person who decided to chase after a violent white guy who hit his car, that, I appreciate that, but the fact that the white guy was more prepared than he was shows how we must get into self-defense mode. See, because when I thought of that, I immediately thought of Joseph Walker and Joseph Harvey. Immediately how Walker at least was ready for the threat. Especially when it appears that the law enforcement officer, but the law enforcement officer did not care about him, about this white guy coming at this black person with a machete. I mean, did the law enforcement officer honestly say that no one was there to corroborate it? I mean, usually...
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I say usually one person makes a statement, the officer investigates it, see if he has the weapon or not. That's it. And since it was proven this guy had the weapon, of course, in being white, he doesn't get charged with anything, that this is only equal to a accident claim. And now this black person is saying he's scared for his life, that this white guy may come after him. And considering how this white guy was let go, who's to say that he won't, you know, follow him around and then make up a fake self-defense claim? I could see another Zimmerman situation where he provokes this black guy and then tell them and say, oh, it was self-defense because he came at me and I had no choice but to kill him. You know, that's really all I have to say. So, you know, we black people, just if you're going to confront these racists, you know, just have the means to defend yourself. That's all.
Just I wanted to get in real quick before I get to the other callers on the point that M1 just raised about self-defense and situations like this. Mr. Fuller, I've heard him talk about this before in terms, and I mean everything goes back to, if you don't understand racism, white supremacy, white people, everything else will confuse you. And I think that in many of these situations, us not understanding white people, and the fact that in this system, whites, they joke, they laugh about committing acts of violence against black people all the time. This is not something that is limited to white people that are going to vote for Donald Trump or the white people that are at his rallies and that sort of thing. This is white culture. This is what it means to be white. So in those situations, I would say, hey, even if you follow this person, you have, you know, whatever, you have your firearms and you feel like you're ready for self-defense, even something like that. I think Mr. Fuller, I've heard him say, you need to be looking at this as though this is combat, as though this is going to be, some people are going to die today. I might be one. My child is with me, might be one. This white person, he might have other white people that he can call to say that he needs assistance or what have you, that, you know, this is going to be, a whole lot of people are going to die today based on what just happened. And he said, if you are not prepared for it to go to get that intense, then you should maybe think about it, because that is exactly what happens in a lot of these cases. And it sounds like even in this instance, the one you're talking about in Virginia, where this race soldier had a machete and threatened this black male with his child in the vehicle, that it could have been that sort of thing. To really have that in mind, even the Detective Walker situation, number one, he wasn't just a civilian. He was a trained law enforcement officer. But even that situation where he shot and killed a white person who had been practicing racism, even that situation, it could have been very, very bad for him. Ultimately, it went to trial and he was acquitted. But I mean, he could have went to jail for the next, you know, 30, 40, 50 years. And, you know, we've had people call in before who said that they're OK with that. Hey, if I go to jail for the next 50 years, no problem. I can accept that for doing what I need to do in defending myself. Fine, no problem. But just thinking that is the system of white supremacy, and really having that in mind anytime, any of these. And that's why I say, when white people, they can totally ruin your life in about 5 minutes. I'm not saying that for exaggeration. I'm not saying that to be funny. I'm saying that because it's true. If anything, it might not even take 5 minutes. It sounded like this incident happened within about seconds. And if anything, I was also thinking it should be hit and run. I thought if you had some sort of vehicle collision or what have you, if it was a moving collision, that is a hit and run. If you leave the scene of an accident, that in and of itself should have been grounds for some sort of criminal charges, unless my understanding of the law is in error. Maybe it's different in the great Commonwealth of Virginia. But I thought if you leave the scene of an accident, that in and of itself is grounds for a crime. At any rate, I think that's very important to have in mind. Just planning, what is this going to be? What are the results of this going to be? Not just today, but, you know, weeks from today, months from today, years from today, what could happen in a system of racism, white supremacy, in terms of how you want to handle those types of situations? Because I think I even remember people saying in the Detective Walker case that they generally would not encourage chasing after someone if they, you know, hit you on the road and they run, or they're yelling things at you and that sort of thing, that they would encourage just get their license plate number and call it in to enforcement officers. But certainly everyone, you know, has their own conclusion about how you should deal with that sort of a problem. But under the system of white supremacy, things can go bad. I mean, bad is an understatement, things can lead to death. Things can go, you know, it can have a horrendous result for black people in a very short period of time, if that's clear. I don't, if I'm talking crazy, folks can let me know as well. Other folks, if I'm not making sense being logical, you can let me know as well. For other folks that we haven't heard from, had comments, and just want to remind people, please do not wait until we get ready to transition to workplace racism, or they wait until we get to workplace racism and decide that they want to talk about things that have nothing to do with workplace racism. If you could share that now, that would be great. Don't wait until we get ready to transition. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up and we haven't heard from you, please comment now.
Yeah, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wait a minute. Is this the caller? Hang on, caller in Connecticut. I'm just trying to make sure we catch everybody who has not shared. Anybody that we have not heard from, if we have not heard from you, please speak now.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Hello to you, that's the host, and to all the callers, and I'll just be real quick. The clip on Reagan and with Nancy, you know, with the Just Say No. And I just thought it was really kind of funny because the gentleman said something to the fact that, oh, they sat down and I guess they had a news thing on TV back to the president. And the man said, oh, they were like America's parents talking to, you know, their children about these drugs. And I just kind of found that funny that, you know, they're on TV sitting down talking to their children about drugs. And when, you know, he's like in the back room, I guess, with the wayward child, Oliver North, while they're planning, you know, to send guns to Nicaragua to get and drugs to come back and put in our community. So, you know, on one hand, you know, you're presenting this, in my opinion, facade that, oh, we really care, this, that, but then behind the scenes, you're the one who is really, you know, helping to get these drugs into this country, particularly into the black community. And I just want to comment on the young lady that read, something she read about the opioid drugs and stuff and the amount of money that's being put forward. And I think if you see if we're paying attention, you notice we're getting these stories with human faces, if you will. I think last night on 2020, I didn't watch it. I didn't watch it all because I was kind of like keeping my eye on what was going on with Trump out in Chicago. But on 2020, David Muir, he did a whole hour. And this is like the human side of this, you know. Basically, these white people are taking heroin and they're overdosing, you know. So now we get this human side of the story. And this is like the third, but that was 20. That was an hour program, but I remember 60 Minutes did a piece on these young white people who are dropping dead, you know, from the heroin. And I think CBS Sunday Morning did a piece, and, you know, I think they got the drug, what is it, naproxen, some drug that I guess paramedics have that if they come up on somebody who's overdosing this drug that they can give that will stop it. And I think 60 Minutes in their piece, they're even, I guess, now like training, I guess, quote unquote, civilians how to be able to use this drug. That if, you know, to be able to use this drug so that, you know, they can stop an overdose. So that they can stop an overdose. And all I could think of was as this is going on, and I'm just thinking about what went on with crack and what we didn't get. And now, you know, you've got this human face. And I even question, because I know that I'm quite sure there are blacks who also are using heroin. So I'm like, if they come upon a black person having an overdose, does this black person get this naproxen, you know? And, I mean, you just can't help but ask those questions. I mean, it is so obvious. And like I tell people, it is as clear as black and white, the response to this now, that these white people or these young white people are basically dropping in from this drug. And I'll mute my line. I just wanted to say that, and I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Other folks who have not participated, if we have not heard from you, you should speak now. Please do not wait until we get ready to transition to workplace racism.
Good evening, everyone. This is Scotty from North Carolina calling in. Just want to say, Gus, I appreciate at the beginning of the program, you talking about, or after the news clips played, about accurate information and whether or not that's really information we're getting from the corporate media or these white news sources. That is very important. You mentioning also what Dr. Francis Kress Welsing said about reading being very important. And, you know, I have, for whatever reason, I have always loved to read, and particularly history in all different people activity areas. And I have found that that has helped me identify lies. It's the best word to describe what the corporate media engages in, and I should just really say white people's press, to borrow a quote from H. Rapp Brown. So I appreciate you saying that, and in that spirit of providing accurate information, just want to let Thomas know that they do have debates where black people, where it focuses on black issues. Tavis Smiley, and who is some of the other hosts that are sitting in on those? Those usually be on a station like PBS, but, you know, I've only known for it to be like one. Just one, and then they move on. I've never seen the Republican Party go to have a debate where they're being asked questions by black people. I cannot recall. I may be wrong about that, but I've been watching it. I've been paying attention to politics for about 25, 30 years. I cannot recall that happening. So they do do that, and I also think it's interesting, you know, again, about, and also I need to acknowledge BET, although it targets black people, it's not run by black people, it's not owned by black people, and it just goes to show, you know, they target us with entertainment, you know, they target us with entertainment in the other areas of people activity that are very serious. You know, we get very little information from these platforms that are targeting black people. And they will, as Mr. Fuller has said, they will showcase black people on these platforms. And when I read those platforms, I will, of course, identify lies and misinformation. Incorrect information is the best term to use on that. So just wanted to say that. On the Clinton and Sanders, when that was brought up about them being asked if Donald Trump was a racist, when I first I was watching that with family members, and the first thing that came to my mind is they're afraid of Trump because Trump is a very litigious, I think that's a proper term, meaning that they will file a frivolous lawsuit on you in a minute. And that if you call somebody a racist, you better be able to prove it when you're dealing with someone who is known to sue people. I also thought that both of them gave accurate descriptions of what was happening, but they did not call him a racist. I think that's the reason why. But then it also reminded me of something I heard Mr. Fuller say on the program that he does. He says that that We shouldn't be so quick. I'm talking about as black people, as victims. We shouldn't be so quick to use that R word. Like, you know, I think he says when you're filing, like, for example, on the workplace, and you think that racism is being practiced against you, find a way to ask questions or point things out that's in their standard operating procedures that every business have, and see if you could frame it in a way that you don't bring up the R word, you don't mention the R word, because I think Mr. Fuller said, as soon as you say racism, you know, all of a sudden, you know, you're not taken serious by white people and whatnot. So I thought about both of those things, Trump suing people a lot, and, you know, that could be considered libel. If you can't prove he's a racist, I think that might have been at the forefront of their minds. But also, you know, what Mr. Fuller said came to my mind. The other things, the Chicago clip, these PAL leagues, police athletic leagues. I've been seeing a push for that more and more. I do not want the police interacting with my children any kind of way. I don't want, I would not drop my children off and leave them in the care of the police to do any kind of activity without me supervising or whatnot. I understand if, you know, that's the only extracurricular activity in your town or whatnot, but you should never leave your children in the care of the police, because that's a way to confuse the children. Then the children will grow up and they'll be thinking that the police is their friend and they're good guys and all this and that, and they won't have the correct information that their primary job is to catch new slaves for the plantation called prisons and whatnot. In terms of the killing that's going on in Chicago, they're saying, you know, already at this point, this year is twice the rate of what it was during the same time period last year. Even then, and I do subscribe to Chicago newspapers, and one of the things I notice is, you know, they report all these murders and whatnot, but I don't see so many people being put on trial for them. I mean, some people are being caught and put on trial, but for the most part, I do not see anybody being, you know, identified as the perpetrator and arrested. I have seen YouTube clips of Chicago police picking up young men on one side of the town or in one community and then, you know, go drop them off in another gang territory. You know, that's what I'm talking about, the gang violence and whatnot. There are YouTube clips showing that. And then also I would add, you know, if they have not caught the perpetrator, how do you know who's doing the killing? How do we know it's not the police doing the killing? And what I was hearing from that clip is, like, you know, propaganda lies to get black people to say, oh, yeah, we want to be stop and frisk. Yeah, you're right. You were doing it for our own good and whatnot. And that's what I was hearing from them. And again, I don't know who's killing all these people. For all I know, it could be the police killing all these people so that they can, you know, show that they're needed, you know, to control us and whatnot. So I'm just very skeptical when I hear about the high rates of violence going on in Chicago, because I don't know who's doing it, you know. I suspect that the police are involved in that. I mean, look at Laquan McDonald, you know. So yeah. And then the last caller, the black woman who was speaking on Nancy Reagan. One of my comrades in the abolitionist movement rightly pointed out that was the start of the school to prison pipeline, because around that Just Say No campaign, and was I in high school when that came out? Yeah, I was in high school. So I remember the DARE program and all of that type of stuff. But that was when they started passing legislation that if you're found with drugs or if you're alleged to be selling drugs within I don't know how many yards of a police, oh, that's, you know, special charges, extra, you know, extra serious charges that carry more serious penalties is what I mean to say. And that was the beginning of the school to prison pipeline, bringing the dogs into the schools and whatnot and putting the cops in the school. That was the beginning. The Reagans, although the Clintons did speed it up with the legislation that was passed during the 90s, but that was the beginning. Was during the Reagan administration. That was also the period when they started expanding funding for private prisons. That's the beginning of the federal government contracting with private corporations to run these prisons under the guise of saving money and what saving the government money. But, you know, studies have been done that show that it does not save any money. So that was the whole beginning of that. And as she rightly pointed out, you know, Oliver North.
Mr. Reed, hang tight, Mr. Reed. I'm just trying to nab everybody that dialed in. We had a few more callers that hadn't got to share at all. Just hang tight, and I'll make sure if we can get back to you if you want to finish your commentary up before we get to workplace racism. Mr. Scotty Reed, founder, Black Talk Radio Network. Let me see. Anybody else that dialed in that we have not heard from? Just making sure that we can try to get everybody in before we get to workplace racism. Anybody that we have not heard from?
It's Karma. Good evening, everyone. I have a little follow-up because a neighbor and I were speaking on the side of the road, and when Gus played the police clip about the man and his son and the machete, I said, oh, my goodness, you know, the officer, even though he might not be there, he set it up for more violence against the black person by giving this white guy his address. And I really appreciate that now that I've called for the 911 tape of when three sheriff vehicles rolled up on my neighbor and I speaking within 2 minutes. So I was really surprised. I thought I couldn't be surprised anymore because I said it's either a nosy neighbor calling it in because I was black, or it was either the police officers, you know, being, let's go get the black girl. But I was surprised at what it was. The neighbor who called it in said, there's a black lady and a white man, and they're arguing, and she looks very, very afraid of him, and he's all in her face, and he's really intimidating her, and she's shirking back. She says, I just thought if there was someone in the area, they could get over there because she looks like she's really afraid. So that was the 911 call, so I was surprised to hear that. But what I was really shocked about was the dispatch lady who took the call said, you know, after getting the information, okay. And what she sent out to the sheriffs, the deputies who were out there on patrol, she says, there's a black woman and a white man having an argument. A passerby saw it. There's no further information. So she totally changed it around. She totally lied. She left out pertinent information in order to escalate the chance of violence against me. And that was all deliberate. I mean, she could have totally changed that conversation. So when the police officers arrived, they were thinking, you know, maybe I was doing something violent or something. They had no idea that someone thought that I might be in jeopardy. And they said, no, it's just two people having a conversation. So anyway, I was really surprised about that. And I realize now, like with Tamir Rice, there are these people sitting behind closed doors. And white people are always thinking, how are we going to escalate the violence even if we're not going to get in on it directly? So anyway, that's it.
Fascinating. Glad we got the update on that particular incident. Wow. It seemed like you were the one that they had concerns about your safety, and that was not given any regard at all. Wow. Anybody that we have not heard from, you should speak.
Yes, sir.
Go ahead, sir.
Greetings to everyone. My concern lately has been young people. I've heard a couple of the clips that was concerning, I think one of them was something about people taking over a building on a college. I think that's what I heard. And if it is accurate, I would assume that part of the young people that actually did this were non-white black. We kind of like alluded to it a few days ago with the show concerning the student of Dr. Frances Welsing when she was talking about the action part of victims of racism and white supremacy, how a lot of us, which is understandable, have a sense of urgency about the system of racism and white supremacy. But at the same time, you should try to be as accurate as possible in the things that you're thinking about, the things that you are saying and you're doing. The system of racism and white supremacy is not going to take any account of how young you are on the backlash or actions that they take on you. It's been proven. We can go to Cleveland, Ohio, with a child that was murdered by the police. They don't care. Non-white black females, they don't care of the advent of femininity and how females, quote-unquote, should be, when it comes to the system of race and white supremacy, they don't care. They're going to treat black females in the same way that they treat black males, as far as they're concerned. So it is incumbent upon us to understand, even reading or studying or what we're doing is a changing views is action. It actually is action. And at the same time, it's to be expected that white people, when you go to a college campus, are going to be mistreating you, insulting you, humiliating you in any way possible under their code of conduct, quote unquote. So that's where I'm at as far as in my mind right now, as far as young people and their desire to have an understanding of countering a code, anyway, of understanding of code codification when it comes to countering white supremacy, as opposed to emotions leading the actions, that it should be thought should be in the top shelf, a top level of procedure. Anyway, correct thinking, the most accurate thinking, and in turn, the most accurate things that come out your mouth as far as speaking, and in turn, it would probably put you in a place whereas your actions would be as razor sharp in what you are doing also. Thank you for listening.
The folks that have not participated, folks that have not shared at all, do y'all have anything you want to get in before we get to workplace racism?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, guys. So I'm going to make it quick, but I missed some of the first portion. But I did want to mention some of the callers have been talking about the image and what you're seeing on TV. And I just wanted to recommend, I don't know if you've read these books, but The Age of Propaganda is a really good book that discusses some of the thinking or some of the ways that your thinking is influenced by what you see on TV and what you hear. Also, Thinking Fast and Slow, I think by Daniel Kahneman, if I'm getting the name right. He also discusses about how you can be primed for certain emotions and how you're able to, without you consciously thinking about it, you start seeing things in a certain way. So when we hear about these cops that are automatically showing up to a situation and they see you as the aggressor or they see a non-white person as the aggressor, if everything that you see on TV and the media is constantly reinforcing this stereotype of this aggressive black male or black female, they're not even thinking about this sometimes. And I'm definitely not giving anybody a pass, but I'm just saying that these are some things when you start reading these books and you start looking at TV and you start seeing the clips that they choose to show, it starts making a lot more sense. So I'll mute my line.
Anybody else that we have not heard from have commentary they wanted to get in before we get to workplace racism?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. Peace to all the callers and to the hosts and to the platform.
I want to start out with commenting on the Holocaust genocide lynch pictures inside the, was it Joe's Crab Shack, I think?
Yes, sir.
That was definitely a refined racist move, I think, to kind of measure legally what can I do, what can I not do, what can I get away with, what can I not get away with in the area of law, politics or whatever. And what else? Let's see. We had the story about Donald Trump and his fiascos, but I wanted to take notice of a article on the internet and the symbol formation that was in the picture of the article, and it was saying, let's see here, about Donald Trump canceling his rally due to security concerns, and they have a black guy with a Donald Trump poster. He's ripping it apart, and he looks very, excited or animated or whatever. And I found that very significant in the system of racism, white supremacy, that they chose to use this picture for, like, you know, their symbol formation and thought process to say that Donald Trump was canceling his rally. And I definitely think that racism, white supremacy is going through an update to try to affect the brain computers of anybody within the reach of the signal. And so I think that the skill of hacking has to become more, solid amongst the counter-racists as far as hacking the brain computers.
Lots of metaphors.
Oh, okay. Dang, I did. Oh, okay. I see. But, yeah. Yeah, that wasn't a good way to describe that. But, I think that racism, white supremacy is definitely escalating the situation. And it's been a lot of people that's racist white supremacists or racist suspects that's been waiting on a person like Donald Trump to come through. And I think that people's ignorance towards the whole event of Donald Trump and the races that support him is, overwhelming. But excuse my errors, and that's all I had to say for right now.
Right on. Not an error, just, focus for this program, trying to be mindful of the metaphors, but definitely appreciate the content. We will transition to workplace racism. If we missed anybody, you can blame Gus. I think I did get everybody's line, but we might have missed a person or two. Moving forward to workplace racism, the number again, 641-715-3640, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Our first-time caller in Connecticut, I'd said if you wanted to begin workplace racism, feel free. Thought I saw he might have had to leave us. So if he's not here, then, oh well. Feel free
to finish my thought, Gus.
Can you wait till we get to the end of the program? Because I'm trying to – people – we have a
party. No, that's okay. Thank you.
Okay. I'm trying to make sure because people deviate during workplace racism where they're off on other things. Workplace racism, if you have not participated, if you have commentary, feel free. Nabbing any of the folks who just dialed in with a hand up, you should be with us as well. Did folks have commentary on workplace racism?
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I have two workplace racism experiences that I like to share this evening. One of the experiences is I am a representative for the department's management regarding employees who file grievances, and one employee filed a grievance against their manager, and I coordinated it and set up the meeting for all participants to meet to discuss the employee's grievance and the
remedy requested. Now, there's four participants, the employee, the employee's representative, and the manager, and myself. And after the meeting, I discuss with the manager what they want to do in terms of a decision regarding the response. So I have a certain amount of time to respond in writing to the employee and the representative on behalf of the manager. In this instance, I was not able to meet the response time limit or write the response, so I requested a extension on the response time to the employee's representative, who is white. And the employee's representative said, why do you want an extension, and what's the problem? This communication was done through an email, and the tone was so curt that I had to decide not to respond back because it kind of agitated me. So I paused for a while, and then I, instead of responding back, I had gone to my white manager and asked him if they could respond to the email because I shared it with the manager. And once the manager asked me who it was, I told him who the person was. And the manager responded on my behalf. But the manager thought that, my manager thought that the person was black, who was the representative, when in fact the representative was white. And so my manager responded to the representative with a very sarcastic tone and copied me on the email and then came to me and said that, look at the email that I sent. What do you think? This black representative is a problem representative. But to my manager's surprise, he did not realize that the representative was white. So I told him this representative was white, and my manager's demeanor and tone just totally changed to a less rude tone. And I thought to myself, he thought that he was being very sarcastic responding to a black person, but once he realized that his representative was white, his demeanor and tone in his response to this white representative changed. So that was one experience that I had experienced in the workplace. The other one was, and I do want to say the black male is being purged in the workplace. My second experience was I had applied for another job in the agency that I work for, which is a large agency, and there's departments throughout the city that I live in various areas. So I had requested a day off to go to this interview for another job that I had applied for. The interviewers, to my surprise, were a white female and a black manager. Immediate supervisor was going to be the immediate supervisor of the position that I had applied for, but her manager was white. So I had informed my manager that I was going on this job interview so that I would not, I would be paid for the time that I was away from the office. By the time I got back to the office, my white manager informed me that he knew the white manager who I had interviewed with and felt the need to share that with me. And that just, that experience showed me once again that white people talk among themselves, and as a black male, it is very disenchanting to have to experience these clear examples of racism, white supremacy practices in the workplace. No further comment.
Profound, quite profound. with the first one. If folks have comments that they want to add or questions that you would like to ask before moving on to the next person that would like to share about, you know, something that they're dealing with personally. But just with the first anecdote alone, I think someone says pretty regularly that white people are not ignorant about racism. Just the fact that from your observation, this white person, their entire demeanor changed once they found out that they were not dealing with a white person. That they were not dealing with a black person. That wasn't who that they were having this correspondence with, that they were talking to another white person. Then everything changed. Oh, wait a minute. We can be much more amicable, much more professional in how we go about dealing with this. That right there, in my view, is just another illustration. White people are not ignorant about racism. They have a whole set of racist codes, conducts, where they're always supposed to be abusive, terroristic, tacky in the way that they deal with black people. Totally different set of standards for how they deal with white people. Not that they aren't rude and abusive to other white people, but I mean, it's just, it is expected, it is assumed that they're supposed to conduct themselves in this manner if they're dealing with a black person. If I'm talking to another white person, I'm like, oh man, whoops, messed up, I thought I was talking to a nigger, excuse me. That right there, like I said, just further corroborates white people are not, cannot be ignorant about racism. And certainly,
you just described my sentiments exactly. That's exactly how I felt to Gus. Exactly what you said. That's what my sentiments were after he realized that this person was white. His demeanor and tone totally changed.
The networking is obvious as well. We've had, I think, workplace racism is probably one of the best areas that shows in terms of white people communicating with other white people, where they refine how they're going to deal with black people on the job. I think the caller in Michigan where she talked about when they were going to fire her, it seemed like white people did a lot of communicating, private communicating to get their words straight and how they were going to justify terminating her employment. But I think workplace, it really, if you're paying attention, if you're observant, white people, they network, they communicate, they share information, they make sure everybody understands clearly the way that they are supposed to be practicing racism on that particular job, and any updates that might happen to the racist code from day to day, even hour to hour. They do a great job, generally speaking. They do make some errors, but generally speaking, you can really see it in terms of white people networking amongst themselves, racists networking amongst themselves. Do folks have other comments or questions that they wanted to ask on this particular situation? Or I guess it was two specific situations. Hang on. Folks have other commentary. Thank you for sharing. Sir, if folks have other commentary they would like to add, your own personal workplace racism, or if you have triumphs, I say that all the time, if you have figured out some things that work to solve problems, minimize conflict with other non-white people that you're working with, and or things that help neutralize racist activity on the job, we definitely need that. Feel free to share.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, guests, and to the rest of the callers. So there's this guy I go to school with, and he's very overdramatic. He's white, of course. But I remember him saying that he claims that he's 1/8 Creole, and he has permission to say the word nigga, and uses that excuse when he says nigga to any black person he sees. Well, not any black person, but when he talks to a black person and feels that it's necessary to use the word nigga. And mind you, Creole is a combination of black, white, Spanish, and French. And I didn't see any of that on him except for white. So, well, I didn't say anything about that because, one, he wasn't talking to me, but I just kept it to myself and discussed it to myself. But I remember him also saying that he's pansexual. I didn't know what that meant at first, but when we had a health class in history class, because ninth graders have to take a health class, but we learned about the different genders and sexualities, and there I learned pansexual means that you love or like all races, and I never heard of any of those races. I never heard of any of those genders or sexualities in my life. I just knew straight, gay, and lesbian. That's all I knew for a certain amount of time. But then I learned these new terminologies about that. And, yeah, that's all I really wanted to share. But, yeah, so he's, I'll just say, let's just say he's gay. Never heard of the word pansexual, but he claims he's pansexual, and he's 1/8 Creole. I don't believe that at all because I don't see any black in him. I don't see any standing out melanin in him. And, yeah, that's all I wanted to share. Thank you.
Fascinating. This person who I guess saying that he has permission, I think was the term, permission to say nigger. I don't know if he's doing it with the A on the end or what have you, but whatever derivation, he has permission because he's quote unquote Creole. Do you suspect that he is just a white person practicing racism doing this?
Well, I do.
Right on. Right on. Sorry. I was just going to ask about the health information. Did that make sense when they were presenting all these new terms and, as you said, new sexual, I guess, activities and sexual identities? Did it make logical sense to you when they presented this?
Well, no, it didn't.
What did not seem to make sense?
Well, these different terms, for example, pansexual, asexual means, like, you don't care what sex you are. And I just don't get it. You were born to be either one out of two genders, male or female. And I just thought we would just stick to that instead of just gay and bisexual and asexual and demi-boy, demi-girl, all of this transsexual and stuff. Like, I just don't get it sometimes. But then I just have to stick with it. I don't know.
Do they have trans? You're in California, you shared before. Do they have the transgender bathroom issue at your school? Because I know they made that a big to-do, Governor Brown, a couple years ago, and saying that, you know, you however you identify, you can use the bathroom that you want. Has that been an issue at your school at all, or no?
No, we just still use the boys' bathroom and the girls' bathroom.
Okay, okay. Thomas in New York, did you have a question or a comment, sir?
Oh, sorry, I was muted. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Yes, my question to the man is, do the other white kids in the school consider this person to be white?
Well, I don't know about that, but they might. I would assume that they do because, like I said, we wouldn't see any black in him. So my answer to that would probably be yes, most likely.
Oh, okay. Because, I mean, if you wanted to, you could get him in. I mean, I don't know how much trouble he'll get in, but, I mean, you could definitely make a, you know, say, yo, this guy called me a nigger or use him the word nigger, and I don't like it. And if you think other white people think he's white, I mean, he will be reprimanded in some fashion. I mean, I don't know what will happen, but he's breaking code, so they definitely will, you know, reprimand him for doing that, I think. But if, you know, you don't seem to be too sure, so maybe he's not white.
Okay. Always grand to hear from our young caller in the Bay Area, hear what's going on in the school system. Workplace racism for young non-white people. If other folks have questions, comments, or your own examples of workplace racism you would like to share, feel free.
I was going to say it sounds like almost like a male version of the Rachel Dolezal situation where he might be trying to switch to acting as if he's black or has some black blood just to get away with being able to disrespect black people. Where so it just kind of made me think of Rachel Dolezal.
Can I be heard?
Your volume is a little low. If you could speak up, please.
How about that? Is that a little better?
That is an improvement.
Oh, wait. Speaker, hold on.
How about that? Is that any better?
Yes, ma'am. Go ahead.
Okay. Workplace racism. Berkeley, California. So there's an event at the home in Berkeley, California with my client, Negro client. So people came over. His other children came over, grandchildren. And it's a nice event. After his children and grandchildren left, there's people that stayed. It was a Jewish male that stayed. He's a part of the family, quote unquote, because when they came to California, the Jewish people, it looked like from the pictures, immediately kind of intertwined with the black family. So they're adults now. So the Jewish male, he's talking, he's kind of dominating the scene. The Caucasian female that I always talk about, she's there, but she's feeling a little uncomfortable because the other children came down and they don't interact with her. So she's just in her own zone. So after everybody left, except for the people that lived there and the guests, she unwound. So there's a Jewish male in the living room, a black male. We're all just talking. And so he asked the Jewish male, the black male guest, do you remember this song that your dad, we used to sing, talking to the Jewish male? And then so the Jewish male is looking at him like, no, what are you talking about? So the black male sang the song in Hebrew. So he knew the song word for word, and he knew all the terminology and all that. So the Jewish male is getting mad, and he's getting a little red, and so he's just looking like, you know the words? He's like, I don't even know the words. And so he's getting angry, but then, you know, I'm staring at him because, you know, this is exciting for me, so I'm just looking. So he's looking, and then he keeps singing the song, and then the son of my client, he says, oh, hey, say it again. Sing it again. And then so he starts singing it, and so he stands over by the Jewish male singing next to him. So now the Jewish male is agitated because not only does he not know the song, if you ask me, he's agitated because he retained the Hebrew words and language and could still recite it to this day because they're like 58, almost 60 years old now. So he said, yeah, I vaguely remember. He's like, well, yeah, your dad taught me that song. So he's trying to get his composure together. So the Caucasian female, she comes in and she's talking and she's, talking to me. Oh, I just love you. Oh, I just could just eat you up. I just love you. I'm going to have to keep in contact with you. We're going to never separate. I'm going to always keep in contact with you. So I'm just looking at her. So thereafter, because my client passed, thereafter, we're at the repast, and she's there, of course. So her daughter, she has a daughter with the black male, and you can tell that she trained her daughter that she was better than the other children because she's, you know, dual race. So the daughter's like 23. She came with a tiara at this memorial service. So the Caucasians, they all sat at one table at the service for this the client of mine, and I came. So the son, he started speaking, and then what they did to him was he was just sharing his moment. He's like, yeah, because you know me and my friends, you know, because we all grew up like family, and me and my friends. He's speaking to the white men at the table, and they said, well, if you just let us tell the story, you just always want to tell everything. You could just let us tell the story, but it's too late now because you've already told the story. So this is in front of everybody at this service. So the black male felt, you could tell that his feelings were hurt. So he kind of starts stumbling on his words, and then he concluded. And so the Caucasian lady, she steps over and decides she's going to tell somebody about me. Oh, I could just eat her up. I could just and just did this tongue gesture for me. So the guy, the black male, came over and said, well, she said she just wants to eat you up and doing all this stuff. I said, well, look,
I said, this is a repass. I said, I can't deal with that right now. I don't understand who talks like that. You know, she goes both ways. I said, well, this is a repass. I don't want to have this kind of conversation about some female that I'll never be with. That doesn't make any sense. Well, she's really liking you. So she just charges over and says, well, how am I going to keep up with you? I was like, well, you're not. And then so she has this business card. Well, here, I give massages, and I'm a unlicensed chiropractor. So she gives me this card. So, of course, I ball it up and I throw it away because I'm not going to go to her. But I just thought that was so tacky, just kind of describing how tacky white people are, that it just doesn't matter where you are, they're still going to be tacky and trifling. So that's all of my workplace racism, and I'll press mute.
Wowee. Well, I don't know exactly how to conclude on that one, other than I'm glad that you repeated that a few times, that this was a repass where there was a loss of life, and we're supposed to be acting as though we are civilized, at least for, you know, 15 minutes or so, to pay our respects for someone who has transitioned, and this is the behavior that is being exhibited, not just by one white person. I think the totality of it, the white person who was upset because he couldn't remember the song and upset that he didn't get to tell the story. And then this, I mean, wow, that is great workplace racism. And then just once again, white culture, what does it mean to be white? This is what you can expect any and all settings, anytime, worldwide. Wow. Thank you kindly for sharing. Incredible. Folks had any comments that they want? Delectable Negro, that keeps coming to mind. The book, Dr. Curry mentions it all the time. Delectable Negro keeps coming came to mind the whole time that you were sharing. Folks had any questions or commentary they wanted to add on what we just heard? If you had your own incidents that you wanted to share, feel free.
Well, I wanted to give an update on what I've been doing for the last 2 years, because, especially since it's political season. So I decided almost 2 years ago that I wanted to find a way for us to be more self-determinant in the little place that I live. So first I changed I have my own little business, and that would make me a little bit less vulnerable. And then the first thing we did was get rid of the person who was in charge of the elections. So, you know, she quit, you know, with the understanding she wouldn't go to jail. And there were like 5,000 uncounted voter registrations hidden. They were in drawers and in boxes everywhere. But we went ahead with the new guy who was from outside, and he processed all of those. And they immediately brought him before the commission and tried to get him fired. But, you know, we were anticipating that, and he kept his job. So then after we had a new elections administrator, then we said, well, we need people in the office who work with him who kind of look like us. So we petitioned to have more non-white people in the office where they, you know, do the machines and everything. So that was a first. And they immediately brought him before the commission and tried to have him fired again. But, you know, we were expecting that and stopped that. And then we said, well, we need people on the ballot board who count votes after the election who look like us. And this is over the last 2 years. So for the first time ever, we had people on the ballot board who look like us. And so that was done. And then we said, wow, you know, it's these old people at the polling places, you know, who intimidate everyone, and it doesn't look very welcoming for us. And so now we have people who look like us who are there when you come to vote. And there's always been a great deal of pushback, but it's been a little bit at a time. And now we have polling places at the historically black college, and so they get to vote too. And, you know, I just studied and studied and studied. And so this very last election, the black guy that we ran against, you know, the black guy that they wanted us to run, he actually won in a three-way race, 70% of the votes. No one in this No one ever, even if it was just two people running, ever won 70% of the votes, especially a black person. They were freaked out. They were absolutely freaked out that this could happen, even with their own person that they put up to run against the black guy. Also, the highest elected official in the county for the party, we wanted to replace the European guy, who really was a saboteur on so many different levels, with a non-white person. And everyone says that's not going to happen. You're not going to vote a white guy out and put a Latino woman in. And we did. And it just blew this whole area apart. They are just freaked out. And I do believe that I've learned enough over the last 2 years where I can replace the sheriff who was in charge of the jail when Ms. Brand died with another sheriff. And I can slowly, one by one, replace a lot of people. And we can be a little bit more self-determinant. But I would say that that is a huge success, for those things have never happened, ever, in the history of this little place. I think it can be done. Of course, at some point, it's going to get really bad, but it's already getting really bad, so.
Right on. Appreciate the update. Definitely sounds like you all have been able to get black people, I guess, focused and doing some constructive things. Great. Always good to hear. Keep the updates coming as they evolve. Though it has been my experience with whites, if they are upset about new developments that they are not pleased about, they tend to recalibrate, go back, plan, and come back with a different plan to get things back the way that they want it. So definitely be on alert. I'm sure they will have a response, I'm sure.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening to everybody. The job which I've been working for the last 6 months, finally, and I say that kind of laughing, but they offered me a position, a full-time position. I was temporary. And a couple of weeks ago, I actually went through my orientation and was brought on permanently to the company. And during my orientation, it was, from my specific department, it was I and a white woman. And we, at the end of our orientation, we sat down with an older man who proceeded to show us our benefits and all this other stuff. Then at the end of it, he says specifically that certain, you know, that the place where I work, we're all family and everything like that, but certain hires are political. And even if they are political, there shouldn't be any, hopefully there would not be any tension that is created by that, but certain things are, certain hires are political. And he said this a couple of times. And I thought to myself as I was leaving how odd it was, because before we started, he was telling us how the diversity in the place was amazing, how they had really done their due diligence to go out and recruit people from different backgrounds and what have you, and that, you know, racism is dying because, and he literally said, racism is dying, that he sees it more in his grandchildren's generation, and that he thinks it's going to be done in the next 20 to 30 years. And then at the end, he's telling me and this white woman that, you know, our hires were basically political. And this, of course, made absolute sense to me because in my department, on the shift that I worked, when I came in, there were no black men. There were two black women, both of which were fired within a couple of months, but there were no black men. And talking to people, it seems that that was a trend for quite some time. And I wasn't sure if the white lady, the white woman who was with me, who was much younger, noted that this man had put an emphasis on that, but I did. And further, the company just was acquired by a larger company, and this company is actually pretty big by itself, but they had instituted a diversity program to recruit and attract more individuals in the upper management from, quote, diverse backgrounds. The focus of their diversity initiative is not Latinos. It's not Blacks. It is not Native Americans or so-called Indians or anything like that. It's women. And specifically, all of the photographs and promotions which they've been putting out, it's white women. In the entire building, in this building, I think there's 500 or so persons working there. I have seen but three Black people working. One of them in upper management, one of them as a chef or helper, and another on, and I'm talking full-time people, another working a shift opposite of me, actually four of them. But their commitment to diversity doesn't include really putting Black people into positions of power. And it's, as everything's been kind of going politically this year, the tension there has increased. And somebody actually told me one day, some individuals were asking me what I thought politically, and I minced my words, but I told them, because they asked me about Donald Trump and they would not leave me alone about it. So I finally minced my words, but I told them, you know, hey, you know, I'm kind of laughing at the guy because, you know, this is where I knew we'd go. And an individual actually came up to me and said, you know, you might want to be careful, especially when you're on your shift earlier in the night when a lot of the bigwigs are here, because a lot of them are Republican. And they will not like that. So I was very nuanced after that. But thanks very much for listening. Everybody have a great night.
Thanks for sharing that. That is definitely something folks should be mindful of. And I'm sure that's just going to intensify as we get closer to November. It reminds me back when the trial for Trayvon Martin back in 2013, where that, you know, got so much attention and people were talking about it on the job and asking you what you think. I'm sure it's going to be a lot of that. What do you think about Donald Trump? And what about the rally and that sort of thing? I would already get in mind how you're going to respond, whatever you're comfortable saying. If you, you know, want to give your honest thoughts about it, if you want to say that you, you know, you haven't really been paying attention, and that might even be truthful for some people that you really haven't been following it. I'm always a big proponent of asking questions. What do you think about Trump? And you can even answer their question, whatever, you know, whatever your response is. I haven't been paying that much attention, or, you know, I'm just kind of surprised about the whole thing. I didn't really see him being a serious candidate, and now it looks like he's the front runner. What do you think? However you want to deal with that, I definitely think that's one that you should already have your response or responses, if you want to have two or three, already prepared to think about, because I could definitely see that one, that being something that could cause people trouble on the job, being asked about that. And it sounds like they were kind of insisted that you respond to Donald Trump. I could see that, you know, happening to a lot of non-white people on the job. And that being, I always bring this up, where white people, they are trying to provoke you, to get you upset or to get you to respond. They're trying to do that, to just have that in mind already, and how you want to use words skillfully to neutralize that. For other folks, if you all had questions, comments, or if you had your own incidents that you wanted to share.
Gus, can I make a comment to what the caller just said?
Absolutely.
He said something that I have been observing in the workplace, too, about there being no Black males in the workplace. And I know from my own observation and experience that in my department, I was one of three Black males. And to date, two of the Black males have been let go. I don't know what's going on other than what I said, that the black male is being purged from the workplace, and that was one of the reasons why I am looking for another assignment for myself. Not that it would matter, because it would be moving from one plantation to another, but there's something very annoying to me that is going on in the workplace with the black male.
Right. I'm not surprised at all about the white female aspect of it. I think that was what the caller shared as well, that they're, I guess, pushed for. I think he also included, that's why I said we need a term for that, because he said exactly what I had been saying at the top of the program about we need a term for when whites do this, try and restrict it to it's old white people or Republicans or whatever they say. But them having their diversity effort focus on white women, that also seems to be a big part of the codification now as well. Anytime that they bring up issues of diversity or discrimination, it is let's empower white women. And they sometimes will infrequently say white women. They will just say women, but they're talking about white women. They're not including black females or any other non-white females. They're generally talking exclusively about white women. So I'm not surprised about that at all. Oh, did I hear somebody? Your volume is a little low. Did I hear somebody?
Yes, sir. Can I be heard?
That is better. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. I had a few observations from this week. The first was I've been hearing that term brother use as well, because I know, Gus, you've spoken on that before. An older black male, he referred to me as brother, a brother, or whichever. And the white male deputy, he said, "Hey, how come you don't call me that?" And the guy didn't respond. And that was just one quick observation. And the second one was that, the white male who usually engages in that tacky behavior, he likes to joke. And he said this to another white person who was walking to work with a non-white female who just got divorced. So I don't know if they may be chatting or whatnot. And I guess he was wearing what appears to be, from what she told me, a man bag or something. And this guy, I said, "Oh, well, what is that you're wearing around your shoulder?" And she answered for him, saying that it was a man bag. And then this, he says, "Oh, well, that's funny, because I don't see a man." And the other white guy, he just, he ain't saying anything, just shook his head. So the third observation was, I was about to get a signature from the main clerk of the court, and he was doing a marriage ceremony. And I guess he takes pictures with the people who are getting married, and these were some people from Africa, an African country. So the way he was describing the way they wanted to take a picture with him, he was saying he was just taking a picture with the bride and the groom, and there were other people who came with the people getting married, I guess, to witness it, family, relatives, and things like that. And he was saying, "Man, they just all wanted to get in a picture." And I think he used a metaphor when he said, "It was like they wanted to take a picture with the president of the United States." So, you know, he just, I took that as him possibly bragging about him being a white person and the value that's placed on him from non-white people, wherever they may be located. And I found that interesting. The fourth was, there was another couple, I think that term anti-sexual was used, and it was a older, 72-year-old white man with a 21-year-old, I guess he may be called Asian, and they were coming in applying for a marriage license. So everybody just pretty much just in awe and in shock, just looking at that. So that was kind of a little messed up. But this last incident was, there was a couple coming in to get just a marriage license. And it was a white woman, and she was doing all of the talking. And the non-white male, he was standing on the side of her, and they were at the counter talking to the white woman. And she asked him a question about race, because they have to put down a racial classification. And she asked, well, you know, what race is he? And he wasn't saying anything. So she just turned and looked at him and says, oh, well, she started listing what we have. We have a Native American. And she says, oh, well, what else do you have? We have Asian, we have Black, African American, or Hispanic. And then the white woman says, now this is a question about his classification. She says, oh, well, you look a little more Hispanic than Black. This guy isn't saying anything. So I'm like, wow. And she answers for him. So she says, yeah, you look more Hispanic than Black. So she decides for him, and then they just check that off. And I guess they were setting up a date to get a ceremony. So I guess they came back later on. But I was overhearing that conversation. So, yeah, that was pretty much all that I had this week.
Wow. Now, just that right there, that is fascinating, to be on a job where that's part of the job. People, I guess, are coming in to file their paperwork and what have you with the clerk or, you know, court officers. And that's a part of it where they're supposed to be filling out forms that require racial classification. Like, wow, you can learn a lot about racism, white supremacy just with that right there. I mean, I don't know how frequently that happens where people come in and they have to fill it out. And that ends up becoming, you know, some drama where there's some hesitation and people don't know what to put. Or I guess you say in this instance, the white woman, they're talking about a non-white male, it seems, his racial classification. And she just goes ahead and says, well, you look Hispanic to me. So, you know, I don't know if she marked that box or not, but just to say that, and he doesn't give any input or not or explanation. But I mean, that is, wow. Just you could watch, I'm sure, and get all sorts of anecdotes and just understanding. Even if people ask any questions, if they don't understand, or can you explain some of these racial classifications? How do you know if a person is, you know, Hispanic? Do you need information about my parents, or, you know, all of that? How do you make these determinations? I mean, that is just take advantage. Anybody, if you're on a job where they racial classifications are a part of your duties or what's happening in your workplace, that is an extra treat for you as a student of counter-racism. And I think we had another illustration in there about white people not being ignorant as well, where the white guy made his little slick comment about, why don't you call me brother? It seems like the Black person was codified enough to not respond right on for them. I guess almost done. I didn't look at the clock. Oh man, we did our three. We will be back. Minimum, we'll be back on Wednesday. We should have a white woman on the program. She wrote the book, The Family Tree. Karen Brennan. Folks, remember I played the sound clip weeks ago where she wrote this book about basically her white ancestors in Georgia killing Black people, a group of Black people. They killed a Black female and three Black males all at the same time. This apparently was some sort of retaliation. They had been having some sort of tacky, tragic sexual arrangement going on. And a Black person killed one of her white relatives. This is like early 20th century, early 1900s. But a Black person kills one of her white relatives. And then the white people respond in mass and they kill these four Black people. And she does goes to do the archiving to get at the details about what happened with all of this and what ramifications this had for this town in Georgia and what this explains about racism. But she should be on the program. The book is The Family Tree. If folks, it's relatively new. It came out this year. If you want to go to your library, see if they have it, you know, if you want to do some reading to ask some questions. But she should be with us Wednesday normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Looking forward. Always great to have white people on the program. If you have questions, gripes, complaints, something was not clear, feel free to drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com. Untiljustice@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter as well at UntilJustice. Thanks to all the folks who participated. If I botched the switchboard and missed your hand, you were not able to participate. I will try to do better, but I think we did nap, at least most of the folks who dialed in who had a hand up, but I will try to do better if I missed anybody who dialed in this year this week. We will probably be back before Wednesday, so just check. You can check us at Black Talk Radio Network. You can check the Facebook page. You can drop an email if you get confused about when the next program will be, but I suspect we will have a broadcast before Wednesday when Miss Karen Brannon visits us. With that, certainly be safe for the rest of your weekend. I think, unless I'm confused, I think the clocks are moved forward tomorrow. So I guess, you know, make sure you do that so you can be on time with what you have to get done. Certainly, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. I think folks had commentary about the incident in Virginia where the white motorist suspected race soldier had a machete in the vehicle and terrorized a black father with his child in the vehicle on the way to school, no less. That situation could have been way worse if he had been under the influence. You never know when it's going to be Darren Wilson, Daniel Holtzclaw, that is behind you, pulling you over. As I have said consistently, in no time, whites can totally ruin and or end your life. We want to make sure we are lucid, sober, so we can make the best possible decisions to keep ourselves safe and any other folks that we might be responsible for. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us. Oh, call or ask to do the prayer. I've been better about remembering. If you are still with us and you want to do the prayer, proceed, sir.
Yes, I am. Can I ask you a question before I proceed with the prayer?
Yes, sir.
And I don't know if you've ever considered doing a program, or if you have done a program where you've had the participants here share their experiences with trying to give examples to family and friends on incidents of racism, white supremacy, and what responses they've gotten back from family and friends. Have you ever done a program like that? Because, and the reason why I ask is, when I try to share examples of things that go on in terms of racism, white supremacy with family and friends, I get a lot of pushback. And I'm wondering if other participants here on the program get the same experience or examples that I get.
I don't think we've done a program that focused specifically on that, but it's my experience from people that have either called in or people that have corresponded via email or people that I've actually talked to. That seems to be very common when people bring up racism with, you know, family. I'm talking about intimate family members, immediate family members, when they bring up racism incidents that have happened, whether it's personal incidents that have happened to them or things that, you know, have happened in the news to other black people, other non-white people. It seems to be similar where they are very defensive, very hesitant. Racism avoidance disorder kind of kicks in and they do not want to address that problem, and or they just extrapolate from you bringing up racism at all that you hate white people. That's the way that they process it, that you hate white people. And
exactly.
They don't want to be a party to that, and, you know, get out of here with all of your militant hate whitey talk. That's the way that you get perceived, and that kind of shuts everything down. That seems to be very, very prevalent, unfortunately.
Thank you for the work that you do. I'll begin the prayer now. Creator, black people are in a system of racism, white supremacy. Creator, help black people to understand that white people practice racism, white supremacy in all areas of people activity, economics, education, entertainment, health, labor, law, politics, religion, sex, and war, for the ultimate purpose of white genetic survival and to prevent white genetic annihilation on planet Earth. Creator, help black people to systematically transform their behavior for the purpose of justice and to guarantee that no black person is mistreated and to guarantee that the black person that needs help the most gets the most constructive help. Creator, thank you for Dr. Francis Quest Welsing in my lifetime. Creator, help black people to resolve and remedy the problems of racism, white supremacy, and to replace it with justice immediately.
Ashe. Context of white supremacy signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.